Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
So it's not an accident that when he writes about the rise of industrial capitalism, Marx either explicitly mentions or is clearly talking about textile factories. And when I say it's not an accident, I don't just mean that his friend and sometimes collaborator, Frederick Engel, actually ran a textile mill in Manchester and was taking money out of the petty cash drawer in order to keep Marx's family from freezing to death in their London flat. That is also true. But it was really logical that he would talk about textile factories because they were the engine at the heart of the Industrial Revolution until late in the 19th century. They drove the development of most of the other developments which were so important in the transformation of the British and the North American economies. Because textile workers, and there were many of them, increasing in number every year, didn't have time to grow their own food, they created a market for commercial farmers. Because they had to have somewhere to live, they created a market for construction workers and contractors. Because they too had to wear clothes, they also expanded the market for textiles and soon for ready-made clothes. And as they're becoming more and more productive, as the efficiency of spinning and weaving is increasing, they're producing so many clothes that new markets have to be found, new consumer markets have to be opened. And so they also inspire the creation not just of a huge effort by Western merchants to go out around the world and open these new markets in Asia and Africa and other parts of the world and Latin America, but they even inspire the creation of the modern advertising sector because people have to be convinced to buy more clothes and to buy more of them every year and to buy enough so that you can have a whole closet full of them. So all of these developments come from textile factories. And in fact, if you look at the U.S., for instance, you can see that the machine tool industry, the locomotive industry, all of these other industries are staffed by people who get their training in the textile industry. So that's important as well. All of these things come from the textile industry. But they wouldn't have been possible without what was happening in the cotton fields. As demand for cotton textiles grows, if the price of the raw cotton itself had not been kept low enough to continue to enable textile factories to continue to produce cheap textiles, it would not have been possible to open a broad market. The market would have been restricted to those consumers at the higher levels of societies who could afford expensive clothes. Where cotton textiles are so successful is in opening that broad market and continuing to open it. And that depended on low raw cotton prices. So every single day that Charles Ball and someone like, or someone like him, picked 3 or 4 pounds more, the price of raw cotton was kept just a little bit lower. And the price of textiles and clothes made by those factories was kept just a little bit lower. And the market got just a little bit wider.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, January 1, 2016. So I have been told. Definitely feeling the impact. It seems Dr. Welzing was indeed admitted to a hospital in Washington, D.C. Earlier in the week and in critical condition, according to the different reports that I have seen from a variety of different sources. Thoughts, prayers with her and her family. I know she had told me when I spoke with her just a few weeks back that her sister was also having some health difficulties, and her concerns were with her sister also at that time. So just if it's not too much bother, any prayers, thoughts, and constructive energy that can be sent to Dr. Welzing, greatly appreciated. And just hopefully folks will really value all of the time, energy, years she has invested in trying to do as much as possible to help Black people and push us towards a solution to the problem, white supremacy. That being said, and in the spirit of Dr. Welzing, I think she would want us to be not discouraged and continue our efforts. We will put on our thinking cap, study, be attentive as we move forward. Study session number 4, Mr. Edward Baptist. The half has never been told. That was him in the beginning of the audio segment today, and that will relate to exactly what we're going to talk about in the segment this week. With that, we will get started. Context of white supremacy. Study session number 4, Edward Baptist. The half has never been told. We're picking up in chapter 3.
Credit appeared to be turning enslavers' Alabama dreams into reality. Alabama was already third in the United States in total cotton produced and first in per capita production. And not just Alabama enslavers. Between 1815 and 1819, settlers transported nearly 100,000 unfree migrants to southern Louisiana, central Tennessee, and the area around Natchez, Mississippi. These slaves cleared fields bought on spec, grew cotton to make interest payments and keep new loans flowing, and served as collateral besides. The dramatic increase in the ability of would-be entrepreneurs to borrow money had extended their right-handed reach across time and space, over mountains and across seas. Back in New Orleans, where plenty of credit was available for the right hands of those who bought and sold, the bells of the St. Louis Cathedral on the Place d'Armes, just around the corner from Mas Perrot's, rang out at noon, resounding through the conspiratorial coffeehouse buzz. Then, one of the wizards of the credit process arose. This was Toussaint Massy, one of the city's most popular auctioneers. Until now, he had been sitting at a table, observing the people who leaned in a rough line against the wall, puffing on his pipe and glancing occasionally at a sheet of paper. On it were written names, ages, and phrases, some of which might be true. Standing, he turned to face the room. In French-accented English, he explained to the expectant audience that 23 slaves would now be sold by auction. The newspaper had simply said, "Terms will be made known at the time of sale." Enslaved people sold as part of an estate often were sold on longer-term credit of a year or more, granted from local seller to local buyer, usually with a mortgage to protect the lender. Sellers like McLean, who had probably bought his slaves in the Chesapeake with short-term credit that soon would be due, wanted banknotes or easily traded credit in the form of bills of exchange. Massy then explained that the auction would take place outside. He turned and walked out the door. Rachel and William blinked in the sunlight that beat down on the St. Louis street wall. The first person to be pulled out might have been John, at about 50, the oldest in the group. Massy pointed him to the low bench. Tall and light-skinned, John stepped up on the box as white folks filed out of Mas Perrot's and surrounded him in a semicircle. Passers-by paused. Women with market baskets, men striding up from other stores, children white and black, flatboat men from up the river. Enslaved people stood at the back of the crowd, faces blank. A hush settled, broken by creaking wagon wheels and muffled shouts from stevedores on the levee. The moment was here, the one that made trees fall, cotton bales strain against their ropes, filled the stores with goods, sailed paper across oceans and back again, made the world believe. Mossy began to speak, but not an everyday talk. Auctioneers persist long past Mossy's day. One knows what they sound like, but their skills seem antique in a time when most auctions are held impersonally online. But there are two important things to remember about Mossy's job. First, an auction is the purest moment of supply meeting demand, and thus sorting out prices in the capitalist market economy. John, facing the crowd, was a test of the demand for a 50-year-old male human being in New Orleans on a Thursday in January when cotton sales had been strong and credit elastic. Buyers and sellers who heard its outcome would hang a whole array of prices on the amount paid for him. This lesson would shape private sales, affect bidding in later auctions, weigh the numbers inked by slaves' names on estate inventories. Mossy's cajoling, whispered collusions between potential buyers in the crowd, nods and raised hands that signified bids, prices of credit and cotton, all were shaped by and in turn blew back and forth the cloud of information and belief that was the market for slaves. Second, auctioneers then, as now, were expected to weave a spell of excitement about the act of purchasing. Mossy wanted to get the highest possible price, but he also created a community of buyers and sellers there at Mos Perot's. This kind of market-making trained buyers to think about the enslaved in certain ways. As Mossy announced key numbers for John and each of the other subjects of sale who would follow him onto the bench, height, age, and price, he also taught buyers how to see the features this community considered most valuable in an enslaved person. Height was the easiest to learn. You could see it. Enslavers usually paid more for tall men than for short ones. Height was less important for shaping women's prices, but age mattered for both men and women. Enslavers generally paid their highest prices for young men between 18 and 25, or for women between 15 and 22. At going rates in January 1819, McLean might realize between $900 and $1,100 for Ned or William, while women of the same age usually sold for at least $100 or $200 less. Mossy would have to work to get $400 for 50-year-old John. Although enslaved people born in the southwestern United States were considered less likely to die from disease than were new migrants to the region, African Americans from Virginia and Maryland were already important to this market, too. There were simply not enough local prime-age men and women available to meet the demand. And unlike seasoned but savvy locals, a youngster from Virginia might seem like a malleable piece of one's right-handed dreams. Alexander McNeil, for example, told the man selling teenager Henry Watson that he wanted to bring up a boy to suit himself. Moreover, in Maryland at about this time, enslaved men in their early 20s sold for about $500. In New Orleans, Ned or William might bring twice the Chesapeake price. Transport costs average less than $100 per slave, so entrepreneurs who secured enslaved people from older states could undersell locals while still pocketing a huge profit. The transactions of the auction, and indeed of any sale, were more complicated than a simple sale of good X by seller 1 to buyer 2 for price Y or Z. Going by 50s, 10s, or smaller numbers still, bidders competed with each other in ways that were sometimes more about proving oneself than about buying a slave. Methodist minister Wilson Whitaker reported what happened at a North Carolina auction when John Cotton battled with a man the preacher knew only as Dancy. The two first clashed over who would win a cornfield. Then they ran the price of a male slave up to $1,400, New Orleans prices in North Carolina. Dancy could go no higher. But then he called Cotton a damned scoundrel and went for the winner with a whip. So Cotton pulled out his pistol and shot him. The victor fled, leaving a friend to take possession of the enslaved man. At the same time, the auction was a place for finding out how malleable an enslaved person would be in the buyer's right hand, how well they suited the buyer's schemes. Young Lewis Hughes remembered how the buyers pressed him and dozens of other slaves who stood in a formation at a Richmond slave pen. Shoppers passed up and down between the lines, looking the poor creatures over and questioning the women. "What can you do? Are you a good cook? Seamstress? Dairy maid?" And to the men, "Can you plow? Are you a blacksmith? Private sales, made not in public auctions but in one-on-one negotiations, sometimes give a person the chance to size up his or her would-be consumer. On the one hand, if the scuttlebutt in the warehouse told you a prospective buyer lived near the place where you had heard your wife or child or parent had been sold, well then, make yourself the brightest-eyed and most compliant in the bunch. On the other hand, you might not want to be noticed in some cases. To the frightened teenager Henry Watson, Alexander McNeil appeared the very man from whom I should shrink and be afraid. Sharp, gray eyes, a peaked nose, and compressed lips. He was a very bad-looking man, Watson said years later, and Watson never wished to look upon his face again. But be careful. If the seller caught you not selling yourself, you would get whipped. At auctions, the number of white eyes concentrated on one slave's body emboldened questioners and intimidated the questioned. Interrogations replaced coy flirtations. What sort of work can you do? Have you ever run away? The seller might have primed the slave with answers, but a room full of aggressive entrepreneurs pressed, trying to get slaves to stumble and spill the truth. Who taught you how to lay brick? John might have been struck off in 5 minutes so that Mossy could get to the more delectable parts of the bill of fare, but others had to endure half an hour or even longer before they could step down. This was too long to game the questions and answers. To add to the pressure, when whites sensed fatigue, they'd press a man on the block to share a fake companionable swig of brandy, forcing the enslaved to lower his or her defenses and submissively swallow the spit of the people who sold them. No, on the block, only the most desperate plays had a chance. At 15, Delisha Patterson gave this speech, literally from the stump. "Old Judge Miller," she said, "don't you bid for me, 'cause if you do, I would not live on your plantation. I will take a knife and cut my own throat from ear to ear before I would be owned by you." Others wailed from the lines where they waited. "Keep me near my children. Buy me, man who is not as harsh as that other one. I will be a good worker." Some tried a bravado approach, laughing and joking. "See, you cannot break me." But while Judge Miller dropped his bid for Delisha, when the young woman's father begged his current owner to buy his daughter, the man cited her public defiance and refused. Stubbornness could also lead to physical assault. Martha Dixon, sold at an auction in St. Louis, refused to speak when she was ordered to describe herself. The auctioneer had her whipped until she talked. So auctions not only set prices, but also destroyed the facade of negotiation with the enslaved and established a community of right-handed power. The most useful advice was what Charlotte Willis's grandfather discovered on a Mississippi block. Better keep your feelings hid. Some channeled pain and fear into silent fury. As he ascended the auction block, remembered one man, there was hate mingled with my humiliation. The grim satisfaction of focusing on a tightly controlled kernel of hate. This was all most enslaved survivors of the auction could take away as profit from the sale of their own bodies and futures. But uncertainty, humiliation, and threats stunned most minds on the block. Eventually, their bodies revealed the terror. Mothers wailed. Some, physically overwhelmed, couldn't quite follow what was happening. Incoherent, they could barely stand before eyes that measured them, planned for them. "I've seen slaves on Napoleon Street in New Orleans," remembered Elizabeth Heil, "fellow slaves who'd just come off the auction block. Staggering away from Mosparo's behind their new owners, they would be sweating and looking sick." This day, when 17-year-old Mary climbed onto the bench after John stepped down, a buzz probably rippled through the crowd. From Mary, the crowd sought a particular kind of compliance and entertainment. She was wrapped in a different set of codes than the ones that a man signaled. Dredging up the memory of the auction of his half-white, half-sister, which he had to witness in 1830, Tab Gross recalled that her appearance excited the whole crowd of spectators. "Fine young wench," a woman remembered hearing on another occasion. "Who will buy? Who will buy?" Rachel watched. She had been leered at, too, when she came through the door, all the way back to the point of her sale in Baltimore. It had been going on ever since she reached puberty, but sale time was when the forced sexualization of enslaved women's bodies was most explicit. Before the 1830s, and sometimes after, whites usually forced women to strip. Robert Williams saw women required to pull down their dresses. Each one would just have a piece around her waist. Her breast and things would be bare. In the middle of Smithfield, North Carolina, said Cornelia Andrews, slave sellers strip them niggas stark naked and gallop them over the square. In Charleston, enslaved women stood, wrapped only in blankets, on an auction table in the street. The vendue master described their bodies, and a white bidder who took a woman back in the auctioneer's shop could take off the blanket. Auctioneers and bidders would turn a woman around, raise her skirt, slap and plump her to show how fat she was. William Johnson remembered that bidders would come up and feel the women's legs, lift up their garments and examine their hips, feel their breast, and examine them to see if they could bear children. For white people, seeing Mary up on the bench was one of the rewards of membership in the fraternities of entrepreneurs. Men asked questions of women that they did not put to John or William, questions that attempted to force her to acknowledge everything that was being bought and sold. Women who refused to play along could expect white anger, as one observer noted, when answers were demanded to questions usually put by the bidders to slaves on the block, the tears rolled down her cheeks, and her refusal to answer those most disgusting questions met with blood-curdling oaths. Of course, not all white bidders minded resistance. Some relished overcoming it. It was all part of the game. She knew her turn was coming, but as Rachel waited, she heard, punching through the auctioneer's patter, through the probing questions of the men in the crowd, one word that recurred in the murmurs of the prospective buyers lining up credit with the lenders who would back them. This strange but ordinary word floated and hummed around her, bubbling up her ear canal and knocking on the door of the mind. Likewise, it crawled out of pen nibs and spoke on the papers on which some of the men who were still sitting inside Mossboro's were writing. It rested quietly in the darkness of folded letters, sailing out in leather letter satchels in the holds of ships, sealed behind wax but ready to burst off the page and into the world. It spoke of a deeper order, a value structuring the seething water of price setting and price changing. But it also carried its own chaos, dreams of creation, destruction, greatness, order, progress. Machine, metal, fear sweat and field sweat, desire amid the hot cotton bales stacked in the shed. Hand. By the time the auctioneer finished off Mary and announced that William was next, Rachel had heard that word more times that day than she could count. It is a very ordinary word. It was being used in a sense different from the way the entrepreneurs used it when they wrote about their notes of hand and so on. Different, but as interlaced with that meaning as a fist. Enslavers' use of the word hand as a metaphor for the right-handed power that they experienced through participation in modernization seems normal. Pull the thread of hand in Mossy's auction talk, and we will find that it was so deeply embedded in the language and practices of the emerging slave market that we have incorporated it into our history of slavery ever since as if it were a natural term. We miss its non-neutrality in our first pass across a sentence, for we are embarrassingly literate in hand talk. After two centuries, we still translate without thinking John Brandt's 1818 offering of five likely Negro fellows, prime field hands. You see five men like William standing in line beside the bench, don't you? But try to read William Robertson's 1816 advertisement literally. He's planning an auction at a New Orleans church of 20 or 30 Negroes just arrived from Tennessee, consisting principally of working hands. Or take just as literally the precise language of the Louisiana Gazette's boosterish description of the riches that those willing to take the plunge and become planters in its reading area had already gained. Nicholas Lorsell had seven hands only, and yet he made 40 bales of cotton and $593 to the hand. A man with only seven hands. Imagine carpals, metacarpals, nails assembled together and coated with seven sets of muscle and skin. See disembodied hands working, but never holding themselves out for payment. When Massey said the word hand, white people saw not an appendage with five fingers, but four simple letters that pulled a freight of metaphor and real-world effects. 2,000 years earlier, the Greek philosopher Aristotle called the slave the instrument of the owner, a living tool. Aristotle gave formal recognition to the idea that the slave was the master's right-handed will embodied, his hand grasping in the world. His, though she's, were enslavers too. The slave reached when the owner said reach, took when the master's brain sent an impulse down the nerves of social power, all without thinking or reflecting. In important ways, Aristotle's story had always been a lie. Through centuries of slave revolts and endless days of resistance, slaves insisted that they had their own wills. Those wills, in the shape of enslaved Africans, were so strange to Europeans in the first couple of centuries of New World slavery that they did not use the idea of the hand to describe the people whom they held captive. That does not mean they did not try to create as reality the relationships of absolute right-handed power that hand implied. But they also developed an ideology claiming that Africans were radically different from Europeans in order to explain away the gap between seemingly unbridgeable cultural difference and resistance, on the one hand, and the dream of the slave as pure tool, on the other. You can see this in the names they give to the people whom they drove off Middle Passage ships and into sugar and tobacco fields, titles that emphasize the otherness of the Africans. Mbosal, saltwater slaves. Tet, heads. In the 1810s, however, as right-handed power expanded explosively in the southwestern United States, the word hand began to replace head. A clerk working for William Kenner quoted prices to customers. "Negroes have sold here lately," he wrote in 1816, perhaps from a table at Maspero's, "at $600 and $500 per head, for common field hands." The word began to carry a set of newly possible promises about the people whom it labeled. Hand was the ideal form of the commodity slave, just as white crystals are the ideal commodity form of sugarcane. Each person for sale was a commodity, alienable, easily sold, and, in important ways, rendered effectively identical for white entrepreneurs' direct manipulation. Bidders could fit a William, for instance, into the box of the concept hand, an idea that experienced entrepreneurs told newbie Natchez planter John Knight was the archetype he should look for in the slave market. "The qualities and requirements to make first-rate plantation hands," they told him, "began with this. They should be young, say from 16 to 25 years old, stout and active, large deep chest, wide shoulders and hips." To make sure his reader did not miss the point, he underlined and bold inked his summary. "I wish first-rate hands, young and stout." Enslavers in the lower Mississippi Valley wanted to buy those who looked strong enough to bear intense physical labor. Here was William, looking young and stout, and they'd force him to be active, because white men made plans for returns and revenue by the hand, anticipating the amount of value they could extract from a human being straitjacketed into the role of commodity. One calculated power and possibility by the number of hands needed to fell an acre of trees. One denominated the rate of return from ground cleared or cottonseed planted by the hand. E.B. Hicks used hands as a unit of accounting and put as many hands on the river plantation as his business partner. The word delivered because it was continually recalculated from 1,000 different economic relations. As he was buying enslaved people, the white man, in his mind's eye, saw himself working them, reselling them, mortgaging them, making them into money, putting them in his pocket, to use the words of slave owners' threats to many a hand. And here at Maspero's, sellers, auctioneers, buyers, and bidders did specific things to make whole people look, and in certain ways to be, like the obedient right hands of enslavers' future endeavors. They worked to assure buyers that the person on the bench, brought so many miles from home by coffle chain, could call on no sources of external power countervailing against that of the purchaser. "It is better to buy none in families, but to select only choice, first-rate, young hands from 16 to 25 years of age, buying no children or age Negroes, those same old Natchez planters quoted above told John Knight. Before American acquisition, Louisiana enslavers had bought children, adults, and older adults in percentages proportionate to their presence in the population. But after the purchase and the establishment of new trade routes and robust systems of credit, entrepreneurs bidding at Mas Perot's began to demand that Eastern sellers send them young adults ready to start work right away and able to produce profits for years to come. By the five-year period starting in 1815, almost 45% of the enslaved people brought from other states were between the ages of 14 and 25, more than twice as many as the number between 26 and 44, and significantly more than the children aged 13 and under. Enslavers wanted to buy people who had no claim to a special status, who were as unformed as Henry Watson had been in the eyes of Natchez buyer Alexander McNeil. This characteristic made it much easier to talk about them as disembodied hands. But many of those sold at Mas Perot's had in fact acquired various kinds of specialized expertise in the East. In the Chesapeake and Carolinas, enslaved men rose in status by learning trades. They might be blacksmiths or coopers, teamsters or house servants. Women could become servants, cooks, or weavers. Such skills could gain one respite from incessant field labor, or even give hired-out slaves the possibility of keeping some of the earnings. Artisans were even important in Louisiana. Sugar-making, for instance, required a class of trained enslaved experts who supervised the boiling process. They sold for high prices. Whites identified 5% of local slaves sold in New Orleans from 1800 to 1820 with a specific skill. Skills meant that one could claim some authority over a task and tools, a kind of capital accumulated during a unique past. African Americans sent to New Orleans came to Mas Perot's with individual job-related identities, but they came out with those skills erased, at least from the perspective of a claim that they could make on the enslaver. Many a newspaper advertisement for a man from the Chesapeake stated these skills. For example, Anthony, 23, who was to be sold January 5, 1819, at Mas Perot's, was identified as a sawyer, plowman, driver, and good axeman who had been working in a brickyard. Nora, 22, was advertised as an excellent house servant, good seamstress, washer and ironer, good disposition, and careful mother. All 15 women advertised for that particular sale were described as possessing house servant skills, washing, cooking, cleaning, ironing, caring for children. Yet none appeared as a house servant on the bill of sale. Of the 34 men offered, the newspaper advertisement claimed that 27 possessed skills, carpenter, cooper, blacksmith, teamster, and so on. Not a single one had a skill listed upon his sale document, even though enslavers listed skills on similar bills for enslaved people of local origin. Only 1.5% of the bills of sale for enslaved people shipped from Norfolk and sold in New Orleans in 1815 to 1820 list a skill. The other 98.5% might not have come from the fields, but field hands they now were. The handness of Virginia and Maryland slaves, the English, not French, names of the men, their greater stature, the plain kerchief of the women, not an artfully tied chignon like the ones Anglo visitors to New Orleans always noted, the claim that every one of them was raised waiting the table of a Virginia gentleman who had fallen on hard times, such narratives suggested that here was a standard story who could be forced to become a standard hand. Very smart and willing. You can turn his hand to anything. A most valuable subject. You could take away their pasts and make them seem both the ready instrument and the object of the entrepreneur's right-handed power. Enslavers counted on the massive geographic shift over land and water to the southwest, the separations, the silencing, the distance, and the shock of the process of sale to produce isolation and helplessness. That made human beings look, to buyers, like hands. Resistance to handification certainly happened. Many forced migrants from Chesapeake and Kentucky ran away from purchasers in the lower Mississippi Valley in the late 1810s, as numerous newspaper ads testify. But they also seem to have been far more likely than locals to be caught quickly, to return, or to die in the process. They had fewer or no places to hide, and surely fewer people to help them hide. The sugar and cotton plantations, we knew all about them, said Lewis Hayden, remembering a childhood in Kentucky in the 1810s. When a friend was carried off, why, it was the same as death. One way or another, the sale at Mos Perot's marked one as a hand and meant that an old life was over. Right here, on this January day, for instance, William was about to be torn from the last few people who had known him in Maryland. As the bidding on him crept upward, 600, 700, something piqued the interest of a white man in the crowd. Though several bidders already contested the prize, when Louisiana enslaver James Still made his entry, he did so with determination. The numbers rose higher as Massey chanted. When Still's bid hit 900, a typical price at this time for a man of William's age, a hush settled on the crowd. Would someone go higher? At last, Massey's hammer came down to break the silence. Where did it hit? The wall of the building? Perhaps he tapped it on William's head. Some auctioneers did this, infuriating the people they sold. A white helper stepped forward to lead William down off the bench and walked the new hand back into the shop as Still continued shopping. After the sunlight, the darkness disoriented William. The white man sat him down against a wall. Beyond a new clamor outside, William could surely hear the earlier sold people who now sat next to him. Perhaps a woman sobbing, a man panting. Or was he making those noises himself? Meanwhile, Rachel stepped up onto the bench. If she could get her eyes to focus, Rachel tried to read the faces. In the East, the constant exchange of information among the enslaved made it possible for the people being sold to know the reported characters of many possible masters. But Rachel was trapped in full view in a new place, where the face of every enslaver was unknown to her. She did not know, for instance, as the auctioneer's voice rose, that one of the men bidding for her was William Fitz, a merchant trading here and in Baton Rouge. Whether Rachel experienced the minutes through which she stood on the bench as hate, shame, terror, or exposure, she had to face the crowd, and she faced it alone. If Rachel had a husband, he does not appear to have come in the temperance with her. Neither did any children. Yet, given her age, about 25, and the average age of firstborn childbirth for an enslaved woman in the Chesapeake, just over 20, the odds are good that she had children. She was not alone in being alone. Of the 28 slaves sold by McLean at Mos Perot's on January 28, only two, 23-year-old Sophie and her young child, had any discernible family relationship to each other. Throughout the history of slavery in the Southeast, infants and mothers had typically been sold, given, moved, granted, and deeded together. The infant followed the mother in condition, since the womb was slave and the child of a slave mother was thus also the enslaved property of her owner. Often the infant literally followed the mother from place to place. Here, however, the ideal hand did not come with a family. Slave sellers and buyers conspired to break attachments between parents and children, usually before their removal to New Orleans, but sometimes at Mos Perot's itself. Out of 2,567 women 21 years old and up sold by enslavers in New Orleans between 1815 and 1820, we can prove that at least 553 came from outside the city. Of these, enslavers bought 525 without children. Whether women like Rachel did or did not leave children behind in Maryland, they stood on the block alone. Meanwhile, only in six of 553 cases did New Orleans sellers deal the women's husbands with them. Even if one includes those whose origins we cannot demonstrate from the records of sale, between 1815 and 1820, only eight women of 2,567 were sold with their husbands, and only three with both husbands and child. Clearly, more than 1% of all the enslaved women over 20, whether in Louisiana or throughout the South, were married with children. During boom times like these, Southwestern buyers were more interested in extracting value now than in the long-term accumulation strategy that healthy childbirth and well-fed childhoods represented. A woman who was alone would waste none of her labor on children, and men were universally sold without family members. So were many children. On January 5, just 3 weeks before Rachel was sold, 61 slaves from the Chesapeake had been auctioned at Mas Perouse. Among the smart, promising boys, of whom may be anything made of, as the ad put it, were young brothers Ruffin, 8, and Harry, 6. Ruffin went to Jean Armand, up in St. James Parish. Nicholas Henry bought Harry. Ruffin and Harry probably saw each other for the last time at the back wall where William now leaned his weight against the interior bricks. From 1815 to 1820, in fact, New Orleans saw 2,646 sales of children under the age of 13, of whom 1,001 were sold separately from any family member. Their average age was 9. Many were younger, some much younger. Brothers broken apart, mothers taken from daughters and vice versa, all were easier to move, to be anything made of, individual units ready to come in hand in entrepreneurial dreams. To make the parents into mere individuals, children were left back in the Chesapeake to be reared by grandparents and aunts and uncles. So African-American households back east paid the cost of increasing right-handed power in the southwestern United States, just as those did who now stood on the block. Purchasers who made complete the conversion of mother into hand did not have to pay, at least not now. They only needed the belief of those who granted them credit, and that could be bought with the promised future value imputed by a person made hand. As they created the patterns and expectations of a slave trade that made a uniform commodity, hands, perpetually available, men like William Kenner and Hector McLean were doing more than making profits for themselves. Such entrepreneurs, none of whom were slave trading specialists, were creating a market for future slave trading, though other entrepreneurs would wrest it from their hands even as it emerged. The appearance of Francis E. Reeves in Alabama, he also made two trips to Natchez in 1818 and 1819, foretold the future. Without planning to do so, the merchants of New Orleans had paved the way for a later, more organized domestic trade that linked the techniques of the Georgia men to the much greater distances and emerging markets of the Mississippi Valley. They were laying the connecting rails of a national domestic slave market. Before enslaved people were marched to the ship or the flatboat that took them to New Orleans, and long after their first sale at Mas Perouse, the patterns of exchange and newly habitual assumptions there made them the perpetual object of enslavers' plans. An increasingly efficient market for hands was the core of the process that enabled the new men of New Orleans, from Vincent Nulty to Toussaint Massy to James Still and William Fitz, to knot together a nexus of cotton, slaves, and credit. The effects of their endeavors reached far beyond both Mas Perouse and the expanding southwestern United States itself. Cotton bales were the cheap oil of the 19th century. Here, their outflow met the influx of credit to yield a new thing, ever-increasing production and thus ever-increasing economic growth. And to keep schemes and trades bubbling along from Manchester to Liverpool to New Orleans, to the newly staked out faraway tracts of plantation land to be way up the Tennessee River in Alabama, required a mighty belief. The flow of hands into the market made would-be lords of commerce and new planters believe. As hands, Rachel and William were also credit, promissory notes on their sellers' and buyers' future possession and use of right-handed power. There was one more crossroads here at the corner of Charters and St. Louis. But to map this one, we cannot look in the documents that slave buyers had to file after they won the auction. Instead, we must use a slave sale memory handed down to us, one that originated with the woman who stood above this crowd to be the object of inspection and bidding. 40 years after the year when Rachel stood on the bench, a dying grandmother, we do not know her name, reached up from the corn-shuck mattress where she lay under the roof of a Louisiana slave cabin. She grabbed her frightened granddaughter Melinda by the wrist, and she said the last words Melinda would ever hear her speak. "First thing I can remember is that I was standing on a slave block in New Orleans alongside my ma." The place must have been Mas Perouse. The time was the moment of sale that had separated her from her mother and everything that had come before. Moss Perot's shaped the rest of her life, and she had to pass that moment on to her granddaughter in order for Melinda to know her and herself. Here was the crossroads of time and space where Melinda's family history had to begin again. So would it be for thousands of other family histories. Toussaint Mossie brought down the hammer. The last heartbeat of Rachel's old life trickled out of its chamber. Her past and her future had just been killed for the profit of others. William Fitz won her at about $800. Fitz had bought one other person, a man named Frank Boyd, and Fitz was ready to walk his two new slaves back toward the levee and the boat that would carry them up to Baton Rouge. People sold could sometimes hold on to small things that helped them to remember. A pair of gloves worn by a dead mother, a small blanket split with a sister. Perhaps Rachel had an opportunity to say goodbye to William and the others from the Temperance. But from this point forward, she disappears from known documents. Not so for William, or at least not quite yet. He had to wait for James Still to arrange payment for Perry, a young man from the Emile's cargo. At the same auction, McLean also sold Still a young woman named Maria and her infant daughter, America, consigned by Virginian William Coles. And over the next few days, Still also bought Jacob, Murray, Jefferson, and the 9-year-old boy, Braxton, plus 11 slaves from New Orleans merchants Jackson and Reynolds, and 6 from Virginia residents John Stiles and Thomas Wiley. So in less than a week, Still spent over $20,000, mostly on credit, on new hands. A day or two later, Still collected the 25 people whom he had purchased from the city jail and the warehouses where they had been stowed while he shopped. He marched all 25 back to the levee. The chained city slaves leaned on their shovels, watched a different sort of coffle pass. Past the posts, the leaflets flapping in the wind, William walked across a different gangplank onto a steamboat that could churn steadily upriver against the current. Hands loaded barrels purchased by upstream customers. The bell rang, steam rose, the boat began to back away from the levee. The last passengers sprinted to leap the widening gap, papers fluttering in their hands. The steamer gathered headway upstream past moored flatboats and sailing ships. From its deck, the bound passengers watched the landscape unroll. Behind the levee, each mile studded with a bare pole, they saw rectangular fields of stubbled cane stretching back. Right before the Red Church, they passed Destrehan's Manor, the double galleries that belted the house shining with new paint. More big houses were now visible than before 1811. Near each were cabins and long, low barracks and sprawling clusters. After the first day, the cotton fields began to appear. Gangs of laborers moved slowly among the winter brown and bare stalks, hoeing them under. The boat passed Iberville Parish, and there were few sugar plantations. By the time it reached Baton Rouge, there were only cotton fields and woods. But by then, Still had already disembarked his hands. William and all the rest had vanished into the slave country, a land populated almost entirely by walking, working hands. 4. Left Hand, 1805 to 1861. On July 5, 1805, almost 15 years before William disappeared into the cotton country with James Still, Charles Ball jogged down a South Carolina road. Ball had carried iron chains on his wrists and neck for 500 miles down to South Carolina. Then the slave trader, McGiffin, had sold him to Wade Hampton at a Columbia Inn as part of the local 4th of July celebration. And now it was late morning. Hampton sat low between the two wheels of a stylish, horse-drawn chaise, periodically flicking a long, thin whip. He had told Ball to keep up, so Ball and the horse ran. Years later, Ball bragged that in his youth he could cover 50 miles a day. Still, he surely began to flag after 2 or 3 hours. What Ball eventually remembered most about that long day's run, however, was not his ragged breath, but the grove of huge trees through which the road periodically wound. He anticipated each one, grateful that he'd be jogging in the shade for a few minutes. The smell of the trees reached him before he even saw them. Once he was under them, the magnolia's sweet, musky odor overwhelmed him. Ever since the Civil War, magnolias have signaled plantations, and in popular understandings of what slavery was like, movies, novels, tourism, the pages of Southern Living, and even many historians' scholarly accounts, plantations were places where things didn't change. But as he ran out of the magnolia's shadow, Ball passed one newly cleared field after another. On the left was one full of stumps and piles of logs and brush. On the right, a black wreck of charred logs and ashes. He jogged past still another, this one covered with rows of nearly waist-high green plants, slaves among them, bending and rising in lines between the rows. The night before, he had sat outside the inn and talked with an enslaved man who had once lived just across the Potomac River from where Ball had grown up, a part of Maryland where slaves whispered rumors to each other, saying that down south where the Georgia man took you, you'd have to eat cottonseed instead of food. The man told Ball that no, he'd have meat and meal, but the man assured him that his work in the cotton fields would be far more difficult and draining than the long hours of labor he had served in Maryland. The kind of slavery that Ball was encountering and that was emerging on the frontiers of the early 19th century South was inherently new. For centuries, slavery in the New World had expanded by a process of extension, adding new slaves, clearing new fields from the next sugar island. The southwestern frontier was expanding, in part, via a similar strategy, though on an unprecedented geographical scale. It was not an island, but a subcontinent's rich interior stripped from its inhabitants. And not mere battalions, but whole armies of slaves were now being moved to new soil. By 1820, whites had already transported more than 200,000 enslaved people to the South's new frontiers in the years since 1790. What made this forced migration truly different was that it led to continuous increases in productivity per person, which economists call efficiency. The two ways out of this Malthusian trap were either to incorporate more ghost acres, land outside of industrializing core regions like Britain, or soon the northeastern United States, or to create systematic increases in efficiency of production. The first slavery had not yielded continuous improvements in labor productivity. On the 19th century cotton frontier, however, enslavers extracted more production from each enslaved person every year. The source of this ever-rising productivity wasn't a machine like the ones that were crucial to the textile mills. In fact, you could say that the business end of the new cotton technology was a whip. And the fact that slave labor was unpaid and compelled by brute force was not new. The reality was as old as the human institution of slavery itself. Just as old was the fact that those who were compelled to knuckle under to right-handed power used the art of secret resistance, such as slowing the pace of work when overseers were out of sight, to undermine the sway of the dominant. It had been the same in traditional societies for all those millennia when serfs, peasants, and slaves made up most of the labor force of most societies. Their craft was much like what Protestant reformer Martin Luther in the 16th century called left-handed power. The strength of the poor and the weak, the secret way of seemingly passive resistance to evil. Peasants and servants broke employers' tools, lied, played dumb, escaped from masters. At the same time, they kept their secrets about all their crafts. In older slave regions like the Chesapeake, where Charles Ball had learned to cut and cradle wheat, a secret way of doing or making was a treasure that gave an enslaved man or woman a kind of leverage in his or her dealings with enslavers. Yet, in the fields past the magnolia grove, the dynamic of right-handed domination and left-handed resistance, a struggle as old as the pyramids, was changing. Something profoundly new was happening. Enslavers were finding ways to turn the left hand against the enslaved. Entrepreneurs redirected left-handed power by measuring work, implementing continuous surveillance of labor, and calibrating time and torture. All of this repeatedly accomplished enslavers' ongoing goal of forcing enslaved people to invent, over and over, ways to make their own labor more efficient and profitable for their owners. New techniques that extracted ever greater cotton efficiency radically changed the experience of enslaved people like Charles Ball and the 1 million who followed him onto the cotton fields. But they also transformed the world beyond the fields. The amount of cotton the South grew increased almost every single year from 1800, when enslaved African Americans made 1.4 million pounds of cotton, to 1860, when they harvested almost 2 billion pounds. 80% of all the cotton grown in the United States was exported across the Atlantic, almost all of it to Britain. Cotton was the most important raw material of the Industrial Revolution that created our modern world economy. By 1820, the ability of enslaved people in southwestern frontier fields to produce more cotton of a higher quality for less drove most other producing regions out of the world market. Enslaved African Americans were the world's most efficient producers of cotton. And they got more efficient every year, which is why the real price of the most important raw material of the Industrial Revolution declined by 1860 to 15% of its 1790 cost, even as demand for it increased by 500%. Cotton also drove U.S. expansion, enabling the young country to grow from a narrow coastal belt into a vast, powerful nation with the fastest-growing economy in the world. Between the 1790s and 1820, the United States acquired a near monopoly on the world's most widely traded commodity, and after 1820, cotton accounted for a majority of all U.S. exports. And all of the transformations that spun from these facts depended on changes inflicted on the left hand. A little while before sunset, the chaise finally stopped in the drive before Hampton's house, near the Congaree River. Ball bent over, panting and retching. When he finally raised his head, Hampton's teenage son was staring at him. The boy sneered with a contemptuous menace and asked Ball if he knew how to pick cotton. Just then, the elder Hampton walked past. He ordered Ball to put the horse away and help the gardener. In the garden, Ball pulled weeds as his body cooled from the run. As the sun set, a boy came with a message. Come to the overseer's house to find out where to stay that evening. As they walked away from the big house where Hampton lived, they heard the oncoming tramp of feet. From the lowering dusk strode the slave labor camp's white overseer. After him straggled 170 black men, women, and children. Behind them, night fell on the fields. Before sunrise, a loud, braying noise shattered Ball's sleep. When the overseer's horn blew for the second time, his bare feet hit the dirt floor. He stumbled out of the hut to which he had been assigned, rubbed his eyes, and looked around to see something new. Around him, shaping up like day laborers, was the army he'd seen the previous evening. In Maryland and Virginia, labor crews usually numbered only a dozen or so. These people also looked different. Even after a month-long march south, it could be seen that my shirt and trousers had once been distinct and separate garments. Not one of the others had on even the remains of two articles of clothing. Many of the men wore only long, tattered shirts. Many women only had skirts. Some teenage boys and girls were completely naked, and the state of the bodies thus exposed worried Ball even more. Their skin was reddish and ashy, their hair matted and stringy. Bones stood out. Skin hung slack where muscle had atrophied. As Ball took in his new peers, the overseer stepped into their midst. Here was a tightly contained white man, of a type much like McGiffin, the Georgia man. He turned, beckoned silently, and the crowd followed. A wretched-looking troop we were, Ball said years later, picturing the moment, still watching them and himself marching toward the fields of green, waist-high plants that soon loomed up in the gloaming. They trudged past uncounted rows, through a mile of clods drying from the hoe. Beyond a grove of trees, the rising sun showed that a vast field opened beyond. On its edge, the overseer stopped them. He announced 11 men as captains for the day, and from his slate named 15 laborers to follow each. Ball was to go with Simon. Marching his troop to a section of planted furrows, Simon posted his soldiers, one adult or two children, to the head of each row. Every forced migrant whose story has survived tells us that when they crossed the threshold of the fields of a new slave labor camp, they entered a world that was fundamentally different from the one in which they had toiled before. As Ball lined up by the first waist-high cotton plant of his row, he was about to learn a new way of working, one meant to occupy most of the waking moments remaining to him on Earth. He saw Simon take a row, lift his hoe, and begin to work rapidly down the side of his furrow. Everyone else began to do the same, in a great hurry. Ball could see that each of them had to chop all the weeds in their row without damaging the cotton plants. But then the man in the next row warned him that no one was allowed to fall behind the captain. Ball realized that thus, the overseer had nothing to do but to keep Simon hard at work, and he was certain that all the others must work equally hard. And the overseer was already stalking across the rows, whip in hand. Ball put his head down and kept his hoe moving, trying to keep up with Simon's furious pace. By the time he reached the end of the first row, Charles Ball had been exposed to crucial differences between the forms of enslaved labor demanded in Maryland and the new ones in the cotton frontier. Survivors identified these differences not as idiosyncrasies, but as a new system of enslaved labor. Most forced migrants had been brought up working according to the rules of one of two southeastern regimes. In some regions, a task system had prevailed, as in the South Carolina and Georgia Lowcountry. In those rice swamps, each day, enslavers assigned each worker a specific job, custom fixed the volume of each daily piece of labor, so that a man knew that on a day when he had to chop weeds, his task was to cultivate an acre of rice and no more. As historians have pointed out, a long history of negotiations between masters' power and the cunning of the enslaved had created the task system. It contained benefits for both left hand and right. Those who finished early could tend their own gardens, help others to work, or simply relax for an hour or two. Without direct supervision, forced labor was usually inefficient, but tasking relieved enslavers of this dilemma by offering diligent slaves an incentive, free time. No wonder owners who tried to increase customary tasking levels and limit free time faced direct or covert resistance. Yet most enslaved migrants marched to places like Congaree did not come from the Lowcountry. They came from the greater Chesapeake of Virginia, Maryland, and their North Carolina and Kentucky offshoots. A watercolor sketch made in 1798 by Benjamin Latrobe, designer of the U.S. Capitol, shows the prevalent form of labor on Chesapeake tobacco farms. A white overseer stands on a stump, a pipe in his mouth and a whip under his arm, supervising a gang of enslaved women as they cultivate tobacco plants. This gang system relied on direct surveillance of labor, but by whom? Tobacco planters often grew their crop on many small and widely scattered plots of land. They had to coordinate complex operations carried out by small groups. Most had no choice but to delegate surveillance to black drivers who led labor crews outside of direct white observation. And while enslavers in the Chesapeake pushed slaves to carry out their field work quickly, drivers had their own incentives. Workers moved across Chesapeake fields in ragged disorder, set by divergent individual paces, not ranks formed up in lockstep, like the ones that marched that July morning at Congaree. The best-known innovation in the history of cotton production, as every high school history student knows, is the cotton gin. It allowed enslavers to clean as much cotton for market as they could grow and harvest. As far as most historians have been concerned, the gin is where the study of innovation in the production of cotton ends, at least until the invention of the mechanical cotton picker in the 1930s, which ended the sharecropping regime. But here is the question historians should have asked. Once enslavers had the cotton gin, how then did enslavers produce, or have produced by other hands, as much as the gin could clean? For once the gin shattered the processing bottleneck, other limits on production and expansion were cast into new relief. For instance, one constraint was the amount of cheap, fertile land. Another was the lack of labor on the frontier. So, enslaver generals took lands from Indians, enslaver politicians convinced Congress to let slavery expand, and enslaver entrepreneurs created new ways to finance and transport and commodify hands. And given a finite number of captives in their control, entrepreneurs created a complex of labor control practices that enslaved people called the pushing system. This system increased the number of acres each captive was supposed to cultivate. As of 1805, enslavers like Hampton figured that each hand could tend and keep free of weeds 5 acres of cotton per year. Half a century later, that rule of thumb had increased to 10 acres to the hand. In the first minute of labor, Charles Ball had encountered one of the pushing system's tactics, in which overseers usually choose captains like Simon to carry the fore row and set the pace. We do not know who invented the pushing system, but it was already present when Charles Ball got to Congaree in 1805. And slavery's entrepreneurs carried it west and south, sharing it as they went, like Johnny Cottonseed. You find the Virginian upon Red River, you find the North Carolina man, the South Carolina man, the man from Georgia alongside of him, wrote one enslaver about the new neighborhoods in which greenhorns from tobacco or rice regions learned from their peers how to extract the maximum number of acres from each hand. On early summer visits to town, migrant entrepreneurs began their street corner conversations by asking, "Well, how does your cotton look?" Thus, wrote another migrant planter, any increased quantity of product by any new course of cultivation spreads like the fire of the American prairie, all the way up to 10 acres to the hand.
Context of white supremacy. So we will pick up here. We are on chapter 4. Again, I have the electronic version of the book, so, you know, if you got a hard copy, I can't really do a lot for you in terms of exact page numbers, but we're kind of in the early portion of chapter 4. Folks would like to chime in to share any thoughts, feel free. The number 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Before we nab some of the folks who dialed in, who have questions, thoughts, comments, as I'm trying to read the footnotes, there are a lot of footnotes. I generally am very appreciative, particularly when we read history books, but any of the books that we read, I try to check the footnotes. I would encourage folks who read along to do the same. You can get a lot of other information. You can validate sources. A lot of times you can find a lot of other great material that you might want to check out and read. So definitely try to get the footnotes for this book and others as we read along. One of the footnotes, when he was talking about all of the rape and sexual deviance, is this is an article title, Cuffy, Fancy Maids, and One-Eyed Men, Rape, Commodification, and the Domestic Slave Trade in the United States. And this is also written by same author, Edward Baptist. This is from 2001. It's approximately 30 pages, report that you can check it out. It is available online. I can link it if you are interested in reading. I might even read a snippet once folks share their commentary. Let's see. The folks, we have Mr. Demery Four. Line should be open, and I will nab other hands as I see folks. Mr. Demery Four, if you have any comments, feel free. Good to hear from you, sir.
Yes. May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Greetings, Gus. I was sorry to hear that Dr. Francis Kress Welsing is ill, but our prayers to the Creator go out to her for a recovery. And I'll get started tonight with my commentary, partly on last week. I didn't get a chance to comment on the use of words like revolt or rebellion. The root word of a rebellion is to rebel, and I don't think that that is the correct way to describe enslaved people who are trying to seek freedom as a rebel. And we could also say that white supremacists are rebels against a system of justice. And that's taken from Mr. Neely Fuller's book, The Word Guy. But on to the text, the use of the word hand, right hand representing power and domination, and the left hand being weak, poor, weak, and subjective. You know, we could say a lot about that because that is also carried over into nowadays terms as far as right wing or left wing to denote, you know, Republicans, Democrat, I guess. But in this reading, the use of credit and the ability to borrow has stimulated interstate slave trade. So now they're having these auctions all over, moving enslaved Africans from place to place. And these auctions, you know, are places, you know, where they sell human beings out in the public to white people that plan to practice racism. And these auctioneers, like they said, Marcy, selling other human beings. And then at the end, when he's hitting the gravel on the stand, he would often just hit the heads of the enslaved people just to, you know, it's bad enough that he's selling a human being, but then he's going to hit the man over the head with the gavel. But killing white people were actually just acting a fool, you know, killing each other over slaves. Enslaved people had become a commodity, and you could just look at it as, you know, I guess valuing, you know, that much money, whatever the enslaved person was worth. I noticed the book mentioned something about the slaves or the enslaved people judging white people by their looks, which we know from studying that looks can be deceiving, but they had very little to go on besides rumors of what one slave master, how he would be different from any of the others. And the book did mention something about each plantation or each slave camp would be different. And I kind of do not agree with that, because if you're being worked for nothing and you basically used for labor of tobacco and cotton, I don't see how one enslavement camp would be that much different than the other, besides maybe the disposition of the drivers. And Charles Ball, and you know, had a show of humanity, you know, I don't know if we got that for you yet. Anyway, I'll skip that part. But it does show that enslaved people like Charles Ball had showed tremendous stamina, I would say, you know, channeling pain and fear into silent rage. Because you got somebody up on a auction block, You know, you humiliate them. They're naked, and they're pinching them, prodding them, and whatever else forms of humiliation they can perpetrate on them. There's some hate building up along with humility, and you would have to have a strong sense of a spiritual belief system that would help you to have some ray of hope. You know, probably something that they brought from the African culture. I know that in East Africa and certain parts of Africa that they put a lot of reverence on ancestors. And so I believe that they look towards the ancestors for strength during that time. And I just want to mention that they talked all this about cotton, but they never failed to mention Eli Whitney, the slave who invented the cotton gin. There was no mention of white female slave owners, but we know from Solomon Northrop's 12 Years a Slave that white women did own slaves. There was a Madam McCoy in that book that owned hundreds of slaves. Maybe it's a deliberate effort on the author to preserve the character or whatever of white women. But slave sellers and buyers conspired to break attachments between parents and families because they felt children and younger adults were more, I guess, profitable. So their idea of making a profit would break up families throughout the country. And there were even slave auctions in the capital. And in the book, they show images, and they show an image of two young children, Isaac and Rosa. That picture's in the Library of Congress, but they even looked younger than nine. The book said they would be nine or younger being sold, and I don't see how the mind could even fathom a child that young going off to be imprisoned and enslaved. And the last thing I'll mention is in chapter 4 about the sale of Charles Ball to the racist Wade Hampton as part of a 4th of July celebration. Now, 4th of July celebration of freedom while denying other human beings their own personal freedom. And to mention this, new techniques they're coming up with to extract more and more labor from enslaved people, techniques as the pushing, where they, if a one slave could do 1 acre of work, they push him into doing 1.5 acres to become more efficient. And the task system where they would assign tasks to poor enslaved people that was undernourished, sick, and muscles were deteriorating. And we can just imagine the shape that their hands were in. And being called a hand is a degrading term anyway. And also the use of the term gang to describe black enslaved people, you know, I felt was incorrect too. I'll mute my line, give somebody else a chance. Thanks, Gus.
Right on. Everybody else who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. Feel free to chime in.
Hi, greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. This is Ross. Greetings to all the callers and the listeners. And yes, I would like to send up some ancestral blessings and love to Dr. Welsing. I will definitely intensely pray for her, for her speedy recovery. Also, I just wanted to say, like, this section was really, really powerful that we read so far. There's quite a bit of information that I took notes on, but I'll try and just touch base on some of them. On page 97, there was a section that said, to the frightened teenager, Henry Watson, Alexander McNeil, and Alexander McNeil appeared, the very man from whom I should shrink and be afraid, sharp gray eyes, a peaked nose, and compressed lips. He was a very bad-looking man, Watson said over the years, later, and Watson never wished to look upon his face again. But be careful, if the cellar caught you not telling yourself, you could be whipped. And this really speaks to the fact that from the very beginning, we were forced to basically play an active role in our own enslavement and brutalization. And if we did not play the role that they wanted us to play, we just faced more brutalization. And this really speaks to the fact that a lot of what you bring forward does is as far as us not judging other black people, other victims of white supremacy for the different roles, the different decisions they might make on how they choose to deal with the system, even though we may view those, some of them, as incorrect. Basically, we're all suffering under the same system, and for some of us, we don't always make the best choices, and we just have to be understanding of that fact because of the intentional brutality that we suffer as a people. There was another section on page 98 that was really telling. It said, no on the block, only the most desperate plays had a chance. At 15, Alicia Patterson gave this speech literally from the stump. Old Judge Millis, she said, don't you bid for me, because if you do, I would not live on your plantation. I will take a knife and cut my own throat from ear to ear before I would be owned by you. Others will from the lines where they waited. Keep me near my children. Buy me. Man who is not as harsh as that other one, I will be a good worker. Some tried a bravado approach, laughing and joking. See, you cannot break me. But while Judge Miller drops his bid for Delisha, when the young woman's father begs his current owner to buy his daughter, the man cited her public defiance and refused. Stubbornness could also lead to physical assault. Martha Gibson sold at an auction in St. Louis, refused to speak when she was ordered to describe herself. The auctioneer had her whipped until she talked. And this really speaks to the fact that we were really trying to get back our human dignity. I mean, just the idea that she would stand up and basically tell a judge, I'll commit suicide before I let you own me, really speaks to those ancestors that jumped off the ship and rather be food for the sharks than come to this part of the world to be brutalized. It also reminded me of on the ships that they showed in the movie or the series Roots. The ships had the big nets hanging off of the bows, and that was actually to prevent slaves from committing suicide by jumping in the ocean. So this really speaks to the fact that we, from the very beginning, resisted on many levels, and they just literally had every tactic possible to basically break us. And I found that the other area where it speaks of the bravado approach, laughing and joking, to me is telling about the lack of power that we have and that we've always sensed some sort of or had some sort of false bravado. And we've always tried to look at ourselves in a different light as being more powerful than we actually are in the system. So that just one section really spoke point to me. And then there was another section where they spoke of the slaves being on the auction block and how they would force the females to bare their breasts and they would just touch them in the most gross and grotesque ways and just dehumanize them. And this, I actually wrote an essay speaking about this very thing, but this is what I see as the origin of pornography. This is the very beginning of the pornography industry was placing out women on these auction blocks, stripping them, leering at them, jeering at them, fondling them. Just the kind of molestation that we faced, and this was public molestation, so they enjoyed every minute of it, as the text actually said. And just the sheer domination, it really showed that's the core of white supremacy, is just the complete dehumanization of black people. And it's like the lifeblood of white supremacy is just total disrespect of the black body on all levels possible. And it's just really sickening to read, but fascinating as well, because it brings a lot of things home. And I hope a lot of us understand the type of creatures we're dealing with when we deal with white people, wherever we may come across them, racist man, racist woman, and racist child, that is. And also, there was a section, the section where when they speak of the guy hitting the slave on the head, And I just find, like, even in a simple act of that, it's another form of psychological overt dehumanization. So basically, the African's head could be used as a gavel, and the rest of his body could be used to basically propagate, which is for racism, white supremacy, and to basically facilitate their system. This other section on page 106 I found very telling. Even if one includes those whose origins we cannot demonstrate from the records of sale between 1815 and 1820, only 8 women of 2,567 were sold with their husbands, and only 3 with both husband and child. Clearly more than 1% of all enslaved women over 20, whether in Louisiana or throughout the South, were married with children. And it just speaks to the fact that in order to destroy a nation, you have to start with the destruction of the family. And this was like the quintessential thing that they wanted to do. And it reminded me of how when you see white people who breed dogs, you know, they'll take dogs. Sometimes the puppies aren't even old enough to be separated from their mother, but they don't care. They'll just sell them off anyway. And to me, like every time I've seen like white people selling dogs, pit bulls, you name it, I've always thought about ancestors and just, or even Katrina, just casting us all over the place. You would tell them you have relatives in Georgia, and they'll still send you to Utah. So it really just speaks to that constant destruction of the black family. And then Mr. Demi Ford brought up something very telling, too, about the sales of children. And I thought about that, and I thought to myself, selling older people who might have some connections to their African heritage and ancestry and might still be practicing their traditional religion in secret, these are things that you completely can mix when you're taking children that young. It's also easier to brutalize them and ingratiate them into deviant sexual activity, like child rape and molestation, which was rampant all over the place at that point, just like it is right now, even though it's more covert today. So I find that very telling that the numbers grew for younger, much more impressionable children that they can easily psychologically terrorize and indoctrinate into the deviant sexual practices that we see displayed all over the television today. And the last thing I wanted to speak about was, the last section was on page 116 to 117, and it says, and given a finite number of captives in their own control, entrepreneurs created a complex of labor control practices that enslaved people call the pushing system. This system increased the number of acres each captive was supposed to cultivate as of 1805. Enslavers like Hampton figured that each hand could tend and keep free of weeds 5 acres of cotton per year. Half a century later, that rule of thumb increased to 10 acres to the hand. And in the first minute of labor, Charles Ball had encountered one of the pushing system's tactics, in which overseers usually choose captains like Simon to carry the fore row and set the pace. And this really brought me back to something I spoke about. I forget if it was the second meeting or the third, in regards to the competition between the captives, basically between slaves, which was something that was really, really pushed in the Caribbean between different islands. And that right there kind of speaks to the fact that even on that individual level, they created this competition to see who could outpace who, and as a result, increased the production that increased the money that bolstered racism, white supremacy, and then those same sorts of practices of turning one individual enslaved African against another also kind of carries over today in the way that we treat each other and our ability to, nearly Fuller called it showmanship, us trying to show up one another with whatever material possessions we think we have and looking down upon those of us who may not have those same possessions. And it just really brings a lot home to the psychology of white people. I think a lot of people really should get a good understanding of who and what we're dealing with, and hopefully we can start really working and making strides towards ending the system of white supremacy. Thank you for taking my call.
Right. Appreciate that, Roz. Other folks who have a hand up who have not shared yet, do you all have comments you wanted to make sure you got in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Get that speaker phone off. Hello, this is caller from 712. Hello, everyone. And these are the notes that I took tonight. I recognize that it says somebody sold their half-sister, and I think that happened in Smithfield, North Carolina. And some of the questions that the buyers were asking the women, they were too horrible for them to answer. And they They referred to the slaves as the instruments of the owner or the tool, and they noted that the Africans were different than the Europeans. And at the end, it really stuck out about the 10 acres per person. I think they had to make sure there were no weeds and get the cotton picked. It was up from 8 acres, and then they got all the way up to 10 acres per person, and that's astounding, because I have a garden, and I complain about weeding, and it's really not that big, so I can imagine. And those are the notes that I took on the book reading. And from last week, I didn't say anything because it was messing up too bad, but I was disappointed that they said it was only 2 people that had got killed in that revolt. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Right on. Ashe, for no disturbances thus far. Anybody else who had a hand up have comments they want to make sure they got in?
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I would before I get started, like to dedicate my thoughts and what I have to say to the better health for Dr. Francis Chris Wellesley. Awesome read from the standpoint of the information that this white person is giving. Most times in my experiences, when the term comes up about quote-unquote slavery, you get bits and pieces, probably the most popular understanding that I would guess most people, most non-white black people have is the Root series, and that's just about it for most of us. But this particular book, I know there's some other books, but this particular book is pretty meticulous as far as going through the process. I guess that has something to do with the title of it. Number one, I heard something, someone in the background.
I think it was just, it echoed a little bit.
Okay. What I have here, number one, the single most diabolical process, anybody could correct me if they can name some other that matches with it. The single most diabolical process that any group of people have ever been sent through, which gives evidence on the mental and physical issues that exist today. I mean, we still are carrying that poison deep inside us, mentally as well as physically. I mean, it's not just going to go away as easy as some people pretend to think it is going to go away. I mean, we're not, and this information, we're not even halfway, right? We're not even halfway through this book. So it's interesting in that light to get this information. The proficiency of this evil process I have in my notes is of not wasting any inkling of savagery towards mistreating people. It's just unprecedented. I've been to fairs, I've been to the zoos when they still had animals in cages, in the present day ones when they have them in these phony cage, and they're treated way better than what we're reading. History is way better than what we're reading about what took place with us. And when you hear about some other collective mistreatment of people, let's say such as the quote unquote Holocaust, we're talking about what, Gus? Maybe 10 years as far as how long as that lasted from the late 30s to 1945. We're talking about centuries of this going on. And somebody please stop me if I'm not correct on what I'm saying. I mean, centuries of this going on, and this very meticulous but yet diabolical process over and over and over and over and over again. I have down here, and it's just like I've heard plenty of people say, basically what I'm hearing through the read is it's not a question on how and why this part of the world, the white people in this part of the world, have gained so much profit from it. And this area of the earth that's called the quote-unquote United States has obtained power so quickly, such a short period of time, even over their other white brothers and sisters, so to speak, in Europe, on how they obtained that in such a short period of time, and whereas some of these other places, it took hundreds of years for them to do their robbing and stealing and malice. I mean, it took a very short period of time based on these techniques and this process I have down here. I have something here because of this phrase, statute of limitations, we know has been coming up on behalf of victim of racism, Mr. Bill Cosby. Well, the statute of limitations, in my mind, is still irrelevant with this situation because number one, the system of racism and white supremacy still is in existence. A lot of the companies that were created back during that time are still alive and well today. Still alive and well today. And that's all I would want to say for right now. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Anybody that we missed? Anybody who had a hand up to share that we haven't heard from yet? Anybody that we missed? Anybody who has a hand up to share, but we have not heard from yet? Right. Soon we got everybody. Some of the quick notes that I have. Number one.
Well, I'm sorry. Oh. I didn't know I was muted. I apologize. But I do want to give blessings to Dr. Kress. This is Devin in Miami.
Oh, right on. Good to hear from you.
No. Right now, Alexander McNeil, I guess he was one of the purchasers. I was actually, you know, me and my wife were going over the archives, and we were focusing on Area 8 was brought up in this section as far as sex is concerned, because Alexander McNeil stated he, on page 95, he wanted to bring up a boy to suit himself. And listening to the archives back in 2010, the irritated genie of Sophie's, he was indicating how they had actually weaponized sex. And I was thinking of that as well, how one of the slaves had stated that mostly the entire field was naked as they were working. So that was an automatic threat to anybody. You know, they probably thought they could be raped or something like that if they weren't working at speed or doing the productivity that they were supposed to be doing. So I just wanted to point that out, that the writer, I think he slipped and indicated some of the sexual assaults there, the anti-sexual behavior as well. All right.
Oh, right on. If other folks, if you are listening in and you have comments you want to get before we get to the second audio segment, if you haven't shared yet or if you don't have a hand up, we have probably about 15 minutes before we do so. So get your hand up. Don't be bashful. Okay, quick notes. I will get in. Number one, the term, I don't know if people have heard it, but wait a cotton picking minute came to mind as we were reading all of this. And the etymology of that phrase, I'll check on that during the second reading, but it just reminded me of the efficiency that he talks about at the end, and we are going to exact every ounce of the life force from black people in order to profit and benefit racists, white terrorists. That's what that phrase says to me after hearing this section of the book. And even just, I think I've talked about before how white supremacy saturates the language, the words that we use, even a lot of terms that we don't think about their significance. In chapter 3, this is still Left-Handed Power, where he used the term unfree migrants. That really, because I mean, he's talking about enslaved black people, and that term to me is just, we're not being accurate. Let's go ahead and, you know, enslaved, tortured victims of white terrorism, many other terms that could be used that, in my opinion, would be much more accurate. Same paragraph where he says that these quote-unquote unfree migrants, that they served as collateral for whites who were going down to the Louisiana Territory or Alabama to do their cotton plantations. Mr. Fuller talks about it like right now, 2016, that under the system of white supremacy, non-white people, black people serve as literally the bank for racists, white supremacists. And I think that continues, whether you want to talk about greater confinement today with the prison system, and a myriad of other ways that white people, that's the way that they think of us, that's the way that they use us. Even the report that came out about the abuse of black NFL players, billion-dollar conglomerate, the NFL, the new flick concussion and all that. See, moving forward, when he talks about how the auctioneers then as now were expected to weave a spell of excitement about the act of purchasing. Just, I don't typically hear people talk about advertising being associated with slavery. I generally hear people root that in like 20th century, 1900s, and the rise of this. And I think this is extremely important that you are already seeing this much earlier and in relation to the sale of black bodies, males and females, under the system of white supremacy. I thought that was huge, and particularly giving the details about that process. Moving forward, where he says, oh my gosh, the section I think last week where he's describing the coffee houses in New Orleans, and he says that they didn't have wooden floors, that it was sand, which was great. Everybody could spit their tobacco and whatever else, just out, you know, on the sand and fighting and brawling. We had a duel last week, and I said, man, this clarifying that these are just thugs and gangsters. I mean, that should be understood from jump, because these folks are going around stealing people, enslaving them. There's no greater form of injustice. But these folks, I mean, the whole mythology, the whole lie, that whites are somehow that they are cultivated, civilized, refined, that these folks are respectable or admirable. All of that is a total lie. Everything, pretty much everything that we've read is about torture, rape, pillaging, gangsterism, thugism. That's all that I've seen. And that certainly, in my view, continues all the way up to 2016. But the portion where he's talking about these two whites who are fighting over buying a Negro, and they end up getting into a fight and cursing each other out and shooting somebody. Total Ben Tillman, reminded me of South Carolina, same conduct. There's a photograph in my book. Now, this is chapter 3. I can't give you the picture, but it shows, I'll just read the caption. It has a black, looks like it's a black child, and they've got some racist who's groping him and looking in his eyeballs and, you know, all that. And the caption reads, "Inspection was part of the process of establishing a human being as a hand available and ready for sale. This was serious business, but here the enslaved person was required to play a role, standing still, not resisting, answering questions with the most market-friendly responses and behaviors." Meticulous detail. I certainly appreciate that. And I think a lot of that element of white supremacy is still present today. I think we've had so many people who've commented that on jobs, if they're not smiling and feeling like you are happy and jolly and ready to laugh and giggle with whites as we work and slave for their benefit, that you get in trouble. Same type of thing. just for me, it's on the same page where he says you had to be careful. I think folks mentioned the passage where you had an enslaved black female saying that she would take death over being the property, in quotes, of this racist enslaver. Down the page, it says that for black people who tried to resist when they were being auctioned, in not being cheerful or playing dumb or whatever else that they could do to minimize the likelihood of being purchased, it said you'd better be careful. If the seller caught you not selling yourself, you would get whipped. And I think Roz commented eloquently on that portion already. Let's see. Oh, man. The portion where it says to add to the pressure, when whites sensed fatigue, they'd press a man on the block to share a companionable swig of brandy, forcing the enslaved to lower his or her defenses and submissively swallow the spit of the people who sold them. I thought that was a really profound moment. We've talked about the significance of really whites using alcohol, spirits they call it, intoxicants, drugs, using that as a weapon of war against us. I think somebody says sobriety would be best in conditions of white supremacy. And then just even having a drink with them as though I'm going along with this and I've got to try. Oh, man, just the details of what we have endured under white terrorism. A little bit further down, having an enslaved black female, Martha Dixon, having her being beaten because she refused to speak. I mean, wow, this is the type of thing when I say we shouldn't minimize. We should be really honest as possible in talking about racism, white supremacy, because none of this sounds like white privilege to me. Let's see. When all of the explicit detail about the rape and the pornographic nature of enslavement and the buying and selling prostitution of these black people, I thought that was extremely important. And again, he has a whole essay that is exclusively about that. Again, it's titled Cuffy, Fancy Maids and One-Eyed Men, Rape, Commodification, and the Domestic Slave Trade in the United States, by the same author Edward Baptist. I can link it if folks, you know, are interested in checking that out on your own. Let's see. Man, the isolation, I thought that portion was extremely important. The quick sentence, it says, enslavers counted on the massive geographic shift over land and water to the southwest, the separations, the silencing of the distance, and the shock of the process of sale to produce isolation and helplessness. This, to me, is like the concept we talk about social engineering. I think Mr. Fuller has been saying for a long time that the plantations were labs of experimentation. Really, even the slave ships were just boats of experimentation to refine how they were going to torture and dominate black people. And I think he just, again, gives a lot of meticulous detail in the portion that we read this week. But I definitely still see that in practice, even when they incarcerate, have a lot of us in greater confinement. I think one of their newer practices has been, okay, if you commit a crime, if let's say Pennsylvania, if you're in Philadelphia, we're not going to have you be in Philadelphia. We're going to have you be, you know, 5 hours away from where your family is, people that you're close to have you in total isolation and helplessness. I think that is a long running tactic of racist man, racist woman, racist child. And that just continues. Men were universally sold without family members. So were many children. On January 5, just 3 weeks before Rachel was sold, 61 slaves from the Chesapeake had been auctioned at Moss Perot's. And I think exactly the caller had pointed out these young children. There's a whole book. I can give you the title in a second. A whole book that focuses on how many children that this really was child rape. What was happening to so many black children during this process. It just came out within the last 12 months or so. I can give folks the name a little later in the program. The detail really stood out for me. The fact that apparently he went, because it's footnoted, where he went and did research where you can get at least an approximate tally of the number of children that were sold in a given area, New Orleans, from 1815 to 1820. To me, that just, when we say that white people are ignorant about racism, that is a total lie. I'm not saying or implying that every single white person knows all of this detail, but the fact that you have all of this documented, you cannot have a total system of domination and have it run by ignorant people, and particularly have this system to last for centuries. This is meticulous documentation, keeping tabs on their Negroes. And I submit that that continues today, and that white people, you cannot maintain this sort of system and have white people just be bumbling idiots. That is total nonsense. And I just, looking at all of this detail, the fact that they had all this meticulous detail then, and the fact that apparently some of this material has been preserved and is sitting around today where you can go back and check this information out, just to me speaks a volume about, I think, the way Mr. Fuller says it, white people burning midnight oil to maintain an understanding of how to maintain dominance over us. There's another picture of young children in New Orleans who've been sold. For me, it's still in chapter 3. Let's see. Again, Wade Hampton, they did all that talk. I said this last week. They did all that talking about the Confederate flag in South Carolina, in addition to Ben Tillman. His statue is still up, chilling. They got roads and all kinds of things named after reverence to Wade Hampton, racist enslaver, probably was doing some raping of his own down in South Carolina. Let's see. I really appreciated the efficiency, because that's something I submit. I think Mr. Fuller, his concept of refinement, that, I mean, these are interchangeable. Increased efficiency, refinement. Racists really appreciate that in increasing their control, increasing their power, getting better. I think that's why the term practice, when you practice, you get better at something. You refine your efficiency at doing something. That's what I think we heard a lot of. I really appreciated that. Like, get these niggas to clear 5 acres. Within 50 years, we got it up to 10 acres, which is a massive amount of land. I mean, I can't, it's difficult for me to even comprehend being able to do that. I really appreciated the detail with Charles Ball, where he talks about how different the enslaved black people looked on Wade Hampton's plantation, South Carolina, moment for Mother Emanuel AME, but talking about how differently they looked, just ragged, tattered, beaten. Again, this to me does not sound like white privilege or problem of diversity. This just sounds like total terrorism. We should be accurate in the way we describe racism, white supremacy, on into today. I think I will pause there. I think Mr. Demi Ford got in the comment that I also thought was hugely important about a slave being sold as part of the 4th of July festivities. I think that's the sort of thing that we should have in mind, not just when it comes time for July 4 this year, but any and all holidays, New Year's Day, Christmas, Valentine's, anything that until this problem has been solved, there is no celebrating on the black side of the chessboard. With that, folks have anything else they wanted to get in before we get to the second audio segment? We have maybe 2 minutes. If you have something concise that you think is important to get in, feel free.
I wanted to mention quickly about the use of credit in the slave market. They would offer longer-term credit, you know, to locals. And sometimes slaves were being sold as a part of an estate. And they had come up with ways, you know, different type ages, the heights of slaves, which one would bring more than others, and basic business practices. It looked like the whole concept of credit started this way. And there was one other thing. I'll mention it a little later. I'll mute my line right now. Thanks, Gus.
Absolutely. Make sure that we have time for everybody to share. After the second audio segment, we will go ahead and get started. If you did not get to share, or if it's anything else that you really want to make sure that you get in, just write a note down so that you don't forget, and we should have ample time. We are now in chapter 4, Mr. Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told, Context of White Supremacy. This is audio segment number 2.
Enslavers shared innovations because the world cotton market was an example of what economists call perfect competition. In fact, it was the example. It was used later in the 19th century as the archetype in which the great British economist Alfred Marshall discovered the famous concepts of supply and demand curves. The market was so big that no individual producer could control even 1% of the total. This meant that individual producers had no reason to hoard innovations in the extraction of labor from neighbors, for a neighbor's increase in production did not change the price the innovator received by a visible amount. Enslavers also had a vested interest in the ability of their neighbors to suppress their own slaves' resistance. So, planter entrepreneurs readily shared their labor control innovations. "The intercourse of experience," wrote one enslaver, "is the solder of slaveholders' communities, in which every individual is bound, not only by his duties to others, but by his own interests, to extend and nourish this useful interchange of systems." Innovation in violence, in fact, was the foundation of the widely shared pushing system. Enslaved migrants in the field quickly learned what happened if they lagged or resisted. In Mississippi, Alan Sidney saw a man who had fallen behind the four-row fight back against a black driver who tried to whip him up to pace. The white overseer, on horseback, dropped his umbrella, spurred up, and shouted, "Take him down!" The overseer pulled out a pistol and shot the prone man dead. None of the other slaves, Sidney remembered, said a word or turned their heads. They kept on hoeing as if nothing had happened. They had learned that they had to adapt to pushing or face unpredictable but potentially extreme violence. Enslavers organized space so that violent supervision could extract the maximum amount of labor. "A good part of our rows are 550 yards long," wrote one Tennessee cotton planter in the 1820s. He had created a space in which he could easily identify stragglers. He also simultaneously ensured that when he inflicted exemplary punishment, he did so in clear view of a large audience. Though the rows were long and Simon's pace was hard, Ball was getting his wind back at 7 a.m., when they all paused to eat a breakfast of cold cornbread. Charles, Ball, and Simon exchanged a few grunted words as they returned to their side-by-side rows. Already, the captain recognized that Ball was one of the few in the field physically capable of keeping up without panicked effort. Both returned to their toil, hoes swinging like metronomes, sweat rolling down arms and backs. The overseer kept the time. Once an hour, he allowed the men, women, and children to walk over to a wagon loaded with water barrels and drink a ladle full of water. At noon, the hands at Congaree ate another hurried meal. More cornbread, a little salt, one radish each. Ball was catching on to other ways in which the pushing system maximized the amount of labor extracted from him. For instance, the tricks that filled every minute of daylight with money-making labor. At the end of a row, Simon whispered to Ball to conserve what strength he could, for they would have to work until it was too dark to tell cotton from weed. There would be no leaving the field in time to make the evening meal. In fact, the overseer had assigned an old woman to stay back in the quarter and bake everyone's suppertime cornmeal ration. Likewise, when 30 years later, Henry Bibb was transported up Louisiana's Red River to a slave labor camp, his new enslaver ordered slaves to gorge themselves with a heavy breakfast 2 hours before sunlight. They were then allowed but one break before nightfall. If Ball got ahead of Simon for a moment, stood up straight to wipe off the sweat of this long afternoon, and looked around at the bodies behind him, he'd see two more pushing system elements that enabled entrepreneurs like Wade Hampton to plant and cultivate more and more acres of cotton over time. First, almost everybody who lived in Wade Hampton's huts, men and women, children and adults, was in the field. Second, they were all doing the same job. In 1827, a Virginia-born enslaver, wrote to his business partner asking him to procure a number of slaves sufficient to make 40 working hands, which you know, in a cotton country, will be much less than in a grain country. The Chesapeake slave quarters had large numbers of non-working children and old people, as well as those who did some kinds of labor and not others. But cotton entrepreneurs worked men, women, and older children together for most of the year at jobs that were identical. In labor camps like Congaree, a few men became captains, or even drivers. But torn between the interests of enslavers, their own interests, and those of their peers, drivers were subject to frequent demotions. Women, meanwhile, usually did not even have these options. The flattening of the job hierarchy made men, women, and even children roughly equal in the sense that they did the same kind of labor. Many women and children could accomplish some elements of cotton labor just as well as many men. The elimination of most distinctions among the enslaved and the curtailment of possibilities for independence put into practice the theory incipient in the way entrepreneurs sold people at Moss Burrows. Everyone had a uniform status, that of cotton hand. The product of their labor was also uniform. When the row was finished, the long line of red dirt Ball had turned over disappeared into the sameness of hundreds of identical rows of identical green plants, and the rows stretched on ahead. Simon's crew finished one set and started another, still moving at his pace as he carried the lead row. Slowly, slowly, the shadows extended out from the trees on the field's western borders. The vast gang of hands toiled on, all straining to hear the same sound. At last, as dark settled, the overseer called a halt. The laborers shouldered their hoes and turned for home. Along the way, Ball fell into step with a slow-walking woman. She told him her name was Lydia. Worn and haggard, she carried a baby on her back in a sling of cloth. The baby had been fathered a year ago, soon after she had arrived from Ball's own Maryland. They talked as the others outpaced them. But as Ball began to ask her how she had adapted to life in the cotton fields, the overseer's horn blew. "We are too late. Let us run," Lydia blurted. Ball arrived back at the slave cabins just as the overseer finished his roll call. Lydia came toiling up a minute later, with the baby bouncing on her back. "Where have you been?" the overseer demanded. "I only stopped a while to talk to this man," she said, "but I shall never do it again." She began to sob. The overseer ordered her to lie down on her stomach. Handing her baby to another woman, she complied. The white man pulled up her torn shift, exposing her buttocks and back. Then he drew from his belt the lash she had been carrying folded there all day. The whip, 10 feet of plaited cowhide dangling from a weighted handle, was, Ball realized, different from all the other whips that I have ever seen. The impression it made would never leave him. Many other migrants reported the same feeling of shocked discovery. In Virginia and Maryland, white people used cat-o'-nine-tails, short leather whips with multiple thongs. These were dangerous weapons, and Chesapeake enslavers were creative in developing a repertoire of torment to force people to do what they wanted. But this southwestern whip was far worse. In expert hands, it ripped open the air with a sonic boom, tearing gashes through skin and flesh. As the overseer beat Lydia, she screamed and writhed. Her flesh shook. Blood rolled off her back and percolated into the packed, dark soil of the yard. Those who had seen and experienced torture in both the southeastern and southwestern regions universally insisted that it was worse on the southwestern plantations. Ex-slave William Hall remembered that after he was taken to Mississippi, he saw there a great deal of cotton growing and persecution of slaves by men who had used them well back in the southeast. Once the masters got where they could make money, they drove the hands severely. White people also recorded the way that southwestern captivity distilled and intensified slavery. On a sheet of lined notepaper, saved by small-time cotton planter William Bailey, survives a strange set of lyrics in the voice of an enslaved migrant, a man moved to the cotton frontier. "Oh, white folks, I have crossed the mountains. How many miles I didn't count 'em." Perhaps Bailey wrote down verses he heard. Perhaps he wrote them as a darky song parody. Either way, they tell us what people at both ends of the whip understood as its purpose. "Oh, I's left the folks at the old plantation and come down here for my education," he wrote. What did the singer define as his education? "The first that I ever got a lickin' was down at the forks of the cotton pickin'. Oh, it made me dance. It made me tremble. I golly, it made my eyeballs jingle." Survivors of Southwestern torture said that their experiences were so horrific that they made any previous lickin' seem like nothing. Okatabi, a part Choctaw, part African teenager enslaved in Natchez, remembered his first time under what they call in the South the overseer's whip. Tubby stood up for the first few blood-cutting strokes, but then he fell down and passed out. He woke up vomiting. They were still beating him. He slipped into darkness again. Under the whip, people could not speak in sentences or think coherently. They danced, trembled, babbled, lost control of their bodies. Talking to the rest of the white world, enslavers downplayed the damage inflicted by the overseer's whip. Sure, it might etch deep gashes in the skin of its victim, make them tremble or dance, as enslavers said, but it did not disable them. Whites were open with those whom they beat about the whip's purpose. Its point was the way it asserted dominance so educationally that the enslaved would abandon hope of successful resistance to the pushing system's demands. Their plan of getting quantities of cotton, recalled Henry Bibb of the people who drove him to labor on the Red River, is to extort it by the lash. In the context of the pushing system, the whip was as important to making cotton grow as sunshine and rain. That's exactly what Willie Vester, a Mississippi overseer, told his friends back in North Carolina. He hoped to ride back home for a visit on a nice new horse, sporting a suit of fine clothes. To do so, he needed to make a little more money. The way to do that was to walk over the cotton patch and bring my long plaited whip down and say, "Who proud, boys?" and see a few more bales made. Likewise, in 1849, a migrating North Carolina planter hired a Mississippi overseer to ensure that his hands would be followed up from daybreak until dark, as is the custom here. The overseer would drive each four-row in a vast and easily surveyed field, and he would whip up those who fell behind. All that pushing, the owner calculated, would force my Negroes to do twice as much here as Negroes generally do in North Carolina. Finished with beating Lydia, Hampton's overseer turned to Charles Ball, who stood frozen on the edge of the lamplight. "When I get a new Negro under my command," he said, "I never whip it first. I always give him a few days to learn his duty. You ought not to have stayed behind to talk to Lydia, but as this is your first offense, I shall overlook it." Ball nodded mutely and thanked Master Overseer for his kindness. As he chewed his cornbread, he reflected on his new reality. I had now lived through one of the days, a succession of which make up the life of a slave on a cotton plantation, he later wrote. In the course of surviving his first day, Ball had discovered the new pushing system, a system that extracted more work by using oppressively direct supervision combined with torture ratcheted up to far higher levels than he had experienced before. Between 1790 and 1860, these crucial innovations made possible a vast increase in the amount of cotton grown in the United States. They did so at an immense human cost, which could be calculated in many ways. We could count those who caught malaria in the fields of a more intense disease environment, or those who died young, their bodies malnourished by insufficient food and intense labor. The rate of infant mortality in the new slave labor camps was extraordinary. One of every four children born died before reaching his or her first birthday. This is five times the rate of present-day Haiti. The same as the rate that would have been found in the most malaria-infested parts of 19th century West Africa or the Caribbean. See tables 4.2 and 4.3, which can be found in the included bonus material. And every burst of forced migration produced a decrease in the average life expectancy of African Americans, not just for infants, but for the whole population. But other costs cannot be measured. Although Ball had been able to keep up with Simon, he foresaw that the pace of the work on coming days would be difficult and unvarying. He could tell that his clothes would wear down to rags. He also clearly ran the constant risk of suffering violent, humiliating assault. Ball had not been beaten since he was 15. Back in Maryland, he had been what owners called a well-disposed Negro, who tried to build a life within the system. Anyway, the pathological bullies that white supremacy bred in such high numbers preferred easier targets than someone as large and strong as Ball. But he could see that on the Congaree, if white folks thought that doing so would result in more cotton, they would find a way to bend even the toughest black man to the new bullwhip. Intimidated, Ball strove hard in the days that followed to labor at the torrid tempo of the Southwestern pushing system. By the time July rolled toward its close, he had begun to outpace Simon. The hands had chopped weeds from every cotton row three times over, and now the plants were laid by, tall enough to shade the rows and keep down the growth of weeds. Now Ball began to look around. One Sunday, exploring, he found a body dangling in the woods, a runaway, despairing of escape, unwilling to return. Through his own long march, he had stuck to his resolution to stay alive for something better to offer itself. So now, as he hilled sweet potatoes, he calculated how many he could carry in his shirt if he slipped off for Maryland. As he pulled leaves from the corn stalks, fodder for the livestock, he looked at swelling ears and mentally mapped the months when they would be ripe on the stalk on the banks of all the rivers he'd counted and named on his route south. July turned to August. Carbohydrates sweetened in the corn kernels. But something was happening in the cotton fields, too. The plants strained up to man height and added leaves. The branches grew squares or buds. And white people began to dole out pennies to slaves in exchange for baskets woven by firelight. They inspected cotton gin machinery. They checked the weighting of whips. They went to town and bought sacks, new slates, chalk, ledgers, pens, and ink. And they mailed off expectant, calculating letters that yammered on, as the wife of a Louisiana planter complained in 1829, about nothing but how the profits of the cotton now in the fields would let them continue buying plantations and Negroes. "Cotton, cotton, cotton," is the theme of nearly all the conversations nowadays, wrote one migrant to Florida. Even the ladies talk learnedly upon the subject. If you see a knot of planters engaged in earnest conversation, without even approaching, you may know the topic of their discourse. Get within earshot of them, and I will guarantee that the first word that you will hear will be cotton. As planters talked, the squares grew and swelled behind cream and yellow blossoms. Growing heavier every day, they tilted this way and that until stalks arched and groaned. One day, the first bowl exploded open, and then the next one, and then the next. Millions. A white blizzard settled on the green fields. One more night, and another first day in the life of a hand was here. On an early morning at the beginning of September, the overseer ordered the enslaved people at Congaree back into the cotton fields. He gave each man, woman, and child a long sack and ordered them to take a row and start picking. As Ball bent over the plants in the gloam of near dawn, wetting his shirt with cotton leaf dew, he found that picking required sharp eyes, speedy hands, and good coordination. Slip up, and the hand clutched a leaf, or fingers pricked on the hard points of the drying square at the base of the bowl. Grab too much, and a mess of fiber and stem sprung loose in one's hand. Grab too little, and the fingers twisted only a few strands. Finally reaching the end of his first row, Ball emptied his sack into his own large basket. Suddenly, he realized that women and even children were already far down the neighboring rows. As the pickers bent in ever more hurried motion, their hands were blurs. Not just their right hands, in the fastest cases, but their left as well. But when Ball tried to set both hands to work, his arms flailed like disconnected parts. His fingers lumbered. For the first time since he was a boy, he felt out of control of his body. Muscular strength could not solve this task. The sun crawled in a slow parabola across the sky. All day long, the sound of click, click, click rose from almost silent fields as nails tapped on hard pods and fingertips pulled bowls. The overseer rode his horse slowly across the rows, whip in hand. By late afternoon, Ball was exhausted and anxious. Looking left and right at the baskets of others, he felt shrunken, not equal to a boy of 12 or 15 years of age. Cotton picking had little to do with physical strength. It broke down distinctions of size and sex. Women were sometimes the fastest pickers in a cotton slave labor camp. Young migrants could learn picking more quickly than their elders. In fact, Ball heard that a man who has arrived at the age of 25 before he sees a cotton field will never, in the language of the overseers, become a crack picker. In their heads, in conversations, and on paper, planters obsessively calculated equations of hands and cotton, always coming up with the same solution: wealth. A visitor reported that according to Florida calculations, a hand generally makes from 5 to 6 bales weighing 400 pounds. At 15 cents per pound, 5 bales to the hand will give $300. And at 15, 6 bales will give you $360. At 10, 5 bales will give you $200, and 6 bales at 10 cents will give $240. Looking at the soil of Mississippi's Yazoo River District, Clement Jameson concluded, "I shall make close to $250 to the hand." In Alabama, wrote a woman from North Carolina, "A 1,000 witnesses will attest that you may average on each hand about $400 to $600 clear of expense." Making more money allowed one to buy more slaves, thus harvesting more cotton, which meant yet more money. Mississippi farmer L.R. Starks asked a slave dealer to send a young man he wanted to buy at the first opportunity. "I have purchased 5 very likely Negroes this season. We have raised great crops the last season. I am planting 130 acres in cotton. I shall not be able to pay for the boy forthwith, perhaps, but can make the money sure upon time." Yet, as the acres of plants grew and the squares ripened into bowls, the key unknown variable was the speed at which hands would pick. As early as 1800, enslavers deploying the pushing system could make their captives raise more acres of cotton than they could harvest between the time the bowls opened and the time one had to begin planting again. Picking was now the bottleneck. The part of the cotton production process that took the most labor and the part that determined how much money enslavers would make. And as Ball was discovering, picking was difficult, and picking fast was very difficult. In 1820, Mississippi enslaver John Kerr reminded himself that because his brother-in-law's hands were unaccustomed to the cultivation and picking of cotton, it would render it prudent that I not make large calculations on the profit of their labor. Yet enslavers made optimistic calculations nonetheless, because, despite the real difficulty of learning, the amount of cotton that enslaved people picked increased dramatically over time. From 1805, when Charles Ball first dragged his cotton sack down a Congaree row, to 1860 in Mississippi, the amount of cotton the typical hand harvested during a typical day increased 3, 4, 6, or even more times over. In 1801, 28 pounds per day, per picker, was the average from several South Carolina labor camps. By 1818, enslaved people on James Magruder's Mississippi labor camp picked between 50 and 80 pounds per day. A decade later, in Alabama, the totals on one plantation ranged up to 132 pounds, and by the 1840s, on a Mississippi labor camp, the hands averaged 341 pounds each on a good day, the largest that I have ever heard of, the overseer wrote. In the next decade, averages climbed even higher. A study of planter account books that record daily picking totals for individual enslaved people on labor camps across the South found a growth in daily picking totals of 2.1% per year. The increase was even higher if one looks at the growth in the newer southwestern areas in 1860, where the efficiency of picking grew by 2.6% per year from 1811 to 1860, for a total productivity increase of 361%. Almost as remarkable as this dramatic rise in productivity is the fact that the history of the modern world, of industrialization and great divergences, of escape from the Malthusian trap, has almost never noticed it. Or perhaps that should be no surprise. This increase confounds our expectations that dramatic, systematic gains in labor efficiency depend on new machine technologies, such as the continuous series of innovations in spinning and weaving machines that were increasing the productivity of Manchester's textile workers. Some of the climb in cotton picking efficiency may be attributable to a kind of bioengineering. New breeds of cotton, especially the Petit Gulf seed, introduced from Mexico in the 1820s. Yet, if heavy yield and bigger cotton bolls of these breeds made picking individual bolls easier, the richer yield also meant more reaching and bending and moving and grabbing and lifting and carrying, and more expectations. Anyway, picking totals rose continuously. They rose before Petit Gulf, they rose after it. Moreover, while some planters obsessively chased the latest fad for cottonseed varieties, they were marketed with names like Mastodon, 100 Seed, Sugarloaf, and Prolific. Others argued that new breeds added nothing to the picking qualities of Petit Gulf. So, something that cannot be explained by the seeds happened to produce a continuous increase in productivity. That increase had huge consequences for global history. Cotton, like oil later on, was the world's most widely traded commodity. But that analogy doesn't even begin to explain how crucial the ever-growing efficiency of cotton picking was to the modernizing world economy. Neither Britain nor any other country that followed it down the path of textile-based industrialization could have accomplished an economic transformation without the millions of acres of cotton fields of the expanding American South. To replace the fiber it imported from American slave labor camps with an equivalent amount of wool, Britain in 1830 would have had to devote 23 million acres to sheep pasture, more than the sum total of the island's agricultural land. The expanding cotton plantations of America's southwestern region allowed the textile industries to escape Malthusian constraints, and not just by adding additional acres and laborers. Consider this. The total gain in productivity per picker from 1800 to 1860 was almost 400%. And from 1819 to 1860, the increase in the efficiency of workers who tended spinning machines in Manchester cotton mills was about 400%. Meanwhile, the efficiency of workers in weaving mills improved by 600 to 1,000%. Therefore, even as textile factories harnessed increasingly complex machinery to more powerful non-human energy sources, even moving from water to steam power, cotton pickers produced gains in productivity similar to those of cotton factories. And those gains created a huge pie from which many other people around the world took a slice. Lower real cotton prices passed on gains in the form of capital reinvested in more efficient factory equipment, higher wages for the new industrial working class, and revenue for factory owners, enslavers, and governments. Cheaper cotton meant cheaper cloth and clothing. Thus, productivity gains in cotton fields also translated into benefits for consumers of cloth. Most of the world eventually acquired clothes made in the industrial West from cotton picked in the U.S. South. There would be no mechanical cotton picker until the late 1930s. In fact, between 1790 and 1860, there was no mechanical innovation of any kind to speed up the harvesting of cotton. There was nothing like the change from scythe to mechanical reaper, for instance, that by the 1850s began to reshape the Chesapeake wheat fields Ball had left behind. Even slave-operated Louisiana sugar mills were more factory-like than the cotton labor camps were. And the nature of human bodies, the only machine that worked in the cotton fields, did not change between 1805 and 1860. Still, the possibility that enslaved people might have picked more cotton because they picked faster, harder, and with more efficient technique does not come readily to our minds. In fact, during the late antebellum years, northern travelers insisted that slave labor was less efficient than free labor, a point of dogma that most historians and economists have accepted. The same northern observers who proclaimed that slave labor was inefficient had great faith in the idea that free people who were motivated by a cash wage would work harder and smarter than coerced workers. Occasionally, under special circumstances, some enslavers did pay people a wage. In 1828, Edward Barnes paid 8 of the 27 people enslaved on his Mississippi cotton labor camp a total of $28.32 for picking on Sundays, the day of the week when it was technically illegal for enslavers to force field labor. These positive incentives, however, accounted for only 3 to 5% of raw cotton that Barnes's hands harvested in 1828, a year in which he sold 81 bales. In fact, enslavers typically only paid for Sunday picking, if they ever used wages. Most enslavers never used positive incentives at all. And perhaps most conclusively, after the Civil War, when many cotton planters would pay pickers by the pound at the end of a day's work, free labor motivated by a wage did not produce the same amount of cotton per hour of picking as slave labor had. What enslavers used was a system of measurement and negative incentives. Actually, one should avoid such euphemisms. Enslavers used measurement to calibrate torture in order to force cotton pickers to figure out how to increase their own productivity and thus push through the picking bottleneck. The continuous process of innovation thus generated was the ultimate cause of the massive increase in the production of high-quality, cheap cotton, an absolutely necessary increase if the Western world was to burst out of the 10,000-year Malthusian cycle of agriculture. This system confounds our expectations because, like abolitionists, we want to believe that the free labor system is not only more moral than systems of coercion, but more efficient. Faith in that a priori is very useful. It means we never have to resolve existential contradictions between productivity and freedom. And slave labor surely was wasteful and unproductive. Its captives knew it wasted the days and years and centuries extorted from them. They would never get those days back. Yet those who actually endured those days knew the secret that, over time, drove cotton picking to continually higher levels of efficiency. By the evening of his first long day of cotton picking in the Congaree field, Charles Ball hadn't discovered the secret. Not yet. His hands had struggled and shuffled against each other as he observed his fellow slaves moving as frantically as if some demon pursued them. As afternoon moved toward evening, the sun finally neared the western trees. The toiling bodies hunched across the fields, heads bowed, arms moving back and forth between branch and bag, legs shuffling forward down the row. The only sound was the occasional hoarse cry of, "Water! Water!" Children ran back and forth, buckets resting on their heads where within a few weeks a circle of hair would wear off in a ring, visible until February. Dusk now settled, achingly slow, over the field's white glow. At last, tired eyes could not tell bole from leaf. The overseer grunted. Men, women, and children straightened their stiff backs. They trudged to the end of their rows, emptied their last sackfuls into their cotton baskets, and hefted the wicker containers onto their heads. Ball, too. He arched his tired spine to bear the weight and began swaying slowly back toward the open shed that held the cotton. A long half mile later, the final drops of sweat squeezed out of pores, lining tracks in the dust that caked the pickers' bodies. The outbuildings of the camp loomed up from the now full dark. Another day was almost done. Ball had almost survived it. But now, in the yard in front of the cotton shed, he would learn the secret that made hands pick cotton like machines. In a semicircle outside the stand, the open shed that sheltered the gin, Ball and the others put their baskets down. They waited while drivers hung each basket by its handles on a steel yard, a balance beam scale that measured their day's picking. The overseer called out the weight and then chalked the numbers by the picker's name on his slate. Ball had 38 pounds, at least 10 less than most of the other men, even though they were not as strong with the axe or as swift with the hoe. Yet some, and some women and teenagers who had also picked more than Ball, were being taken to the patch of ground where Lydia had been beaten. 20 years after Ball's first day of picking, Israel Campbell went through his own first season at a Mississippi slave labor camp. Try as he might, Campbell could pick no more than 90 pounds between first light and full dark. But the planter, Belfer, had told the young man that his daily minimum was 100 pounds, and that on this day he would have as many lashes as there were pounds short in the draft of cotton recorded beside the name Israel on the Irish-born overseer's slate. A draft was a check that paid off a debt, in the commercial lingo of the time. On the hard-packed earth of Belfer's cotton yard, between the rough-hewn timbers of the gin stand and the packing screw that squashed clean cotton into bales, a kind of accounting took place. It used slate and chalk, balance beam, and one more tool as well. And as Campbell brought his cotton up in the growing darkness, he knew that his weight left him with a negative balance. Desperate to avoid a reckoning, he set his basket down and silently slipped behind the other slaves, lining up outside the circle of torchlight where the Irishman was weighing baskets. He went to hide in the hut where the slaves did their cooking. But just a few moments later, the door opened, and looming backlit on the threshold stood Belfer, lantern in one hand, four stakes and a bullwhip in the other. "Well, Israel, is that you?" The Irishman had weighed Campbell's basket. The account was negative. "I will settle with you now," Belfer said. We can find this system of accounting, experienced by Campbell and Ball, reported again and again by people who were moved to the southwestern cotton fields. Southern whites themselves sometimes admitted that enslavers used the vocabulary of credit and debit accounting to frame weighing and whipping, like this Natchez doctor who, in 1835, described the end of a picking day. "The overseer meets all hands at the scales, with a lamp, scales, and whip. Each basket is carefully weighed, and the net weight of cotton set down upon the slate, opposite the name of the picker. Occasionally, the countenance of an idler may be seen to fall. 'So many pounds short,' cries the overseer, and takes up his whip, exclaiming, 'Step this way, you damn lazy scoundrel,' or 'Short pounds, you bitch.'" Charles Ball's first day total on his slate became the new minimum on his personal account. He understood that if he failed on the next day to pick at least his minimum, 38 pounds, "it would go hard with me. I knew that the lash of the overseer would become familiar with my back." In contrast to the task system of the South Carolina rice swamps, on the cotton frontier, each person was given a unique individual quota, rather than a limit of work fixed by general custom. "The overseer," wrote one owner in the rules he created for his Louisiana labor camp in 1820, "shall see that the people of the plantation that are fit to pick cotton shall do it, and to pick clean as much as possible, and a quantity conforming to their age, strength, and capacities." Sarah Wells remembered that near Warren County, Mississippi, where she grew up, some slaves picked 100 pounds a day, some 300, and some 500. But if your quota was 250 pounds, and one day you didn't reach it, they'd punish you, put you in the stocks, and beat you. If a new hand couldn't meet the set quota, that hand would have to improve his or her capacity for picking, or the whip would balance the account. "You are mistaken when you say your Negroes are ignorant of the proper way of working," wrote Robert Beverly about a new crew transported from Virginia to Alabama. "They only require to be made to do it, by flogging, and that quite often." A few years later, having received another batch of people, he wrote, "They are very difficult Negroes to make pick cotton. I have flogged this day. You would think, if you had seen it, without mercy."
That's where we will pick up at next week. Edward Baptist, "The Half Has Never Been Told." Man. Number to dial, 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-POUND. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments that you want to get in, we should have approximately 30 minutes before we wrap up. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. Feel free to chime in.
Yes, ma'am. Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, a while ago, I wanted to mention about the beating of Lydia, you know, where she had a baby in her arms, and Charles Ball was talking to her, and when the guy did roll call, she was only 1 minute late. And then he's whipping her with this whip, which is used as a deadly weapon. And the whole scene just exaggerates the point that as black men in a system of white supremacy, that we're unable to protect the black woman. And this chart showed that every burst of forced migration produced a decrease in the average lifespan of an African American. That shows that moving us around, marching and all that 500 miles and separating you from your family and children from their parents. And then the another thing I wanted to mention was the health care of the slaves, because in my mind I was thinking about if you wanted the healthiest person and the youngest people, then what about the older handicapped or people with some type of health conditions? What happened to those people? And we can probably imagine that it wasn't a good ending. And this guy, old William Bailey, remembering some song that he had in his mind, that what black people were singing, that's ridiculous, and I don't even know why it's included. But, you know, this book seems to explore every aspect of human suffering when it comes to black people, you know, down to meat being torn off of the bones with the whip and all this. But I noticed back earlier when he mentioned Fort Meems, when over 250 whites was killed, you know, and some was butchered and their heads cut off, decapitated. He didn't go into any of that. So it's a conscious effort not to, you know, give these great details when it comes to white people, but to just over-exaggerate the suffering of blacks. And the last part, the last thing that they were mentioning here, I guess it was about, let's see, the enslavers using measurements to calibrate torture in order to force cotton pickers to figure out how to increase their own productivity and thus push through the picking bottleneck. So these techniques and schemes of white people designed to force the victims to participate in their own destruction. That's the system of white supremacy. I'll mute my line.
Other folks have comments they want to make sure they get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I had a couple of points as well, and the previous caller had some really, really great points, too. There was a section, a piece on page 101 that said, when Mussie said the word hand, white people saw not an appendage with five fingers, but four simple letters that pulled the freight of metaphor and real-world effects. 2,000 years earlier, the Greek philosopher Aristotle called the slave the instrument of the owner, a living tool. Aristotle gave formal recognition to the idea that the slave was the master's right-handed will and body, his hand grasping the world, his, though she were enslavers too. The slave reached when the owner said reach, took when the master's brain sent an impulse down the nerves of social power, all without thinking or reflecting. And this kind of reminds me of, as well, because you just read the fact tone that white people have been devising ways of complete human domination and control since well over 2,000 years ago, first of all. And then second, it really brings home like the concept of the Pavlov dog. And basically that's what they wanted to do, was recreate us as like zombie automatons of white supremacy, doing literally any and everything they said at a moment's notice. And that particular paragraph was very, very, very telling to me in that regard. And then there was another section on page 116 to 117. It says, as historians have pointed out, a long history of negotiations between masters' powers and the cunning of the enslaved had created a caste system. It contained benefits for both left hand and right. Those who finished early could tend to their own gardens, help others to work, or simply relax for an hour or two. Without direct supervision, forced labor was usually inefficient, but tasking relieved enslavers of this dilemma by offering diligent slaves an incentive. Free time. No wonder owners who tried to increase customary tasking levels and limit free time faced direct or covert resistance. And I found this interesting because when I used to work at Comcast, they used to do that sort of stuff all the time. If you did certain amounts of work, they would allow you like an extra lunch break or give them an hour. And I used to say on the job, actually, like, do they really think that they're doing me a favor by giving me an extra half an hour or an hour? And now I'm able to connect literally through this book the origins of that system of thinking, or making us enslaved people think that giving them a little bit of extra so quote unquote free time on the plantation is some sort of gift from heaven, or manna from heaven, from the all powerful white man. And it just brought home that personal experience to me as well. There was a section on page 118 that said, the overseer pulled out a pistol and shot the prone man dead. None of the other slaves, Sidney remembered, said a word or turned their head. They kept on hoeing as if nothing had happened. They learned that they had to adapt to pushing or face unpredictable but potentially extreme violence. Enslavers organized space so that violent supervision could extract the maximum amount of labor. A good part of our roads are 550 yards long, wrote one Tennessee cotton planter in the 1820s. He had created a space in which he could easily identify stragglers. He also simultaneously ensured that when he inflicted exemplary punishment, he did so in clear view of the large force. And this really speaks to the black people being anesthetized intergenerationally when it comes to the destruction of black life. And we see that today in the way that we mistreat each other, how easily it is for us to kill each other for the most minimal infractions due to the system of white supremacy. And it really shows that from the very origin of this system, that was their intent, was not only to terrorize and brutalize us, but also to create a situation in which we would be anesthetized to the violence against our own people. And as a result, in their minds, remain docile. And I see that carrying over in multitudes to this very day. Also, there was a section on the following page that said, the flattening of the job hierarchy made men, women, and even children roughly equal in the sense that they did the same kind of labor. And that one sentence really brought home to me the fact that men and women, the black men and black women, so-called, are not really men and women, but we're children in the system. And that was a form of really social and psychological reduction of our manhood and womanhood to that of a child, in which we would be literally competing with children in order to avoid beating and other forms of terrorism if we did not basically perform to the standards that the white man had set forth. So it really just put a lot of that home. And it also, there was a section that said, oh, this was something that brought something really personal home for me. Boyle arrived back at the slave cabins just as the overseer finished his roll call. Lydia came up toiling a minute later with the baby bouncing on her back. Where have you been? The overseer demanded. I only stopped a while to talk to this man, she said, but I shall never do it again. And she began to sob. The overseer ordered her to lie down on her stomach. Handing her baby to another woman, she complied. The white man pulled up her torn shift, exposing her buttocks and back. Then he drew from his belt the lash that he had been carrying folded all day. And when they described on the following paragraph, the whip 10 feet of plaited cowhide dangling from a native handle was the whip 10 feet of plaited cowhide dangling from a wooden candle was, for a real life, different from all the other whips that I had ever seen. And that whole section where they speak about the cat of nine tails versus the braided whip, and it just goes to the fact that slaves were under a constant, like, consistent form of post-traumatic stress disorder, just watching this kind of brutality on a daily basis. And it brought home a personal story in my own family, in which when my mother actually went to marry my father, my grandfather had actually beaten her, and she described it. I could see the chill in her face. There's something that we call a bull pistol. A lot of people from the Caribbean would be very familiar with that term, which is basically a hardened, dry cow penis that they use to beat you, and it has the same effect on the human body that a cat of nine tails or a braided whip would have, because my mother was practically beaten to within an inch of her life due to my father despising my grandfather despising the fact that she married my father. And it just goes to show how even in my own family, that high level of brutality that was inherited from the slave master and was actually visited upon my own mother due to anti-black sentiments within my own family. And that just really spoke volumes to me. And then the section on page 110 where it says, white people also recorded the way that Southern captivity distilled and intensified slavery. On a sheet of lined milk paper saved by a small-time cotton planter, William Bailey survives a strange set of lyrics on the voice of an enslaved migrant. And that whole section there, where he's basically speaking about the types of violence and how it woke him up to the reality of his quote-unquote education. And basically, their education for black people was violence. And it also speaks to something that Mr. Malcolm X spoke of very, very often, that violence is the only language that white people understand. And I think until we as a people come to a total understanding of the system, once we do, we will understand that more than anything else. And that, again, Malcolm also said we have to speak in the language that they understand. So eventually, we're going to have to speak to them back in that same language. And I hope a lot of us are prepared. I don't think so at this point, but I hope, you know, when the time is right, we're ready to get busy, because it's going to get to that point at some point in the future. And also, there was a section where the author writes about, he says, cotton, cotton, cotton is the theme of nearly all conversations nowadays, wrote one migrant for Florida. And it's just that whole section really brought home the fact that the vast majority of the most deadly things that black people have encountered have been white. White people, white cotton, white flour, white sugar. I mean, you name it, the vast majority of these things are white. And I find that to be a very telling pattern with white people using white items to subjugate, denigrate, destroy, and commit genocide against black people. And then there was another sentence that says, on page 125, it says, looking left and right at the baskets of others, he felt shrunken, speaking of Charles Ball, not equal to a boy of 12 or 15 years of age. Again, speaking to the fact that all black people are children, you know, really sort of really had that so pegged so accurately, the fact that we are not adults in this system. And it really goes to show that in a lot of ways, we are psychologically regressed to the point of children, to the point of even being in competition with children just to avoid brutality. And then there was an area on 127 that said, that had, this was very interesting too. Moreover, while some planters obsessively chased the latest fad for cottonseed varieties, they were marked with names like Mastodon, 100 Seed, Sugarloaf, and Prolific. And this reminds me of the modern day drug trade, in which people who buy brothers different strains of marijuana, different strains of cocaine or heroin, they put these special stamps and labels and these names like Blue Magic and all these different names to basically acquire clientele. And it speaks again to supply and demand and how the whole concept of the whole Wall Street model, credit, all of this was based on the buying and selling and destruction of black bodies. And also the fact that this sort of advertising, quote unquote, is something that is carried over into the modern era that we live through today. And you see that quite a bit. I don't know if anybody's ever seen the show Drugs Inc. On National Geographic, but they speak about that very, very regularly. And then the last section that I wanted to discuss was there's an area on page 130 that says, what enslavers used was a system of measurement and negative thinking. Actually, one could avoid such euphemism. Enslavers used measurement to calibrate torture in order to force cotton pickers to figure out how to increase their own productivity and thus push through the picking bottleneck. And I found this very telling because it says to me that the author is very aware of his own tendencies to practice racism and white supremacy, thus the fact that he corrected himself by saying one should not use such a euphemism. My thing was, why use the euphemism in the first place unless it was to deceive? And then somehow you caught yourself, and in a Freudian slip, you put the facts and the truth out there the way it really should have been said. And I think that's something he could do throughout this entire paper, but he really didn't. And thank you so much for taking my call, and I'll meet my line there.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. What I got out of it, I mean, I got a lot more, but just a couple of points that I made. Mr. Raj says something about, you know, like Mr. Nellie Fuller Jr. says, that we're not adults, we're children to them. I argue that we're nothing but tools and instruments to them, to how they see it, as to what he referred to in the last reading. That's how I feel about that. And last reading, they were talking about what they didn't do on Sunday in that Ross Perot building. They didn't sell slaves, like the hypocrisy. You know, how dare you? What do you mean don't sell slaves on Sundays? And then in this reading, what was the Sunday thing? They referenced something about they didn't do something on this Sunday either. I kind of drew a blank. I had it in my head, but I didn't take notes. I was doing something else. Do you remember what they said about this? They referenced Sunday.
I think it was they had a particular group of enslaved black people. They would allow them to work on Sunday, but since it was illegal for them to work on Sunday, they would give them wages if they would go ahead and work. Some of them, not all.
yes. And I just thought, wow, you know, it's... So I'm glad we're reading this book. A lot of information. I agree with what the other callers said. You know, Mr. Demery Forum and Raj, they always have some good points. So I agree with what they said too. And okay, thank you.
Let's see. I'll get in some of the quick points, and then if anybody else has anything they want to get in briefly before we wrap, we should have a few moments. I thought it was just hugely important. This is in chapter 4, right at the beginning of the audio segment, where he said, enslavers, whites also had a vested interest in the ability of their neighbors to suppress their own slaves' resistance. So planters, entrepreneurs readily shared their labor control innovations. The intercourse of experience, wrote one enslaver, is the solder of slaveholders' community, in which every individual is bound not only by his duties to others, but by his own interests to extend and nourish this useful interchange of systems. Amazing in my ability. And again, I think I've touched on this for 4 weeks now and talking about how the torture, abuse, terrorism against black people is a galvanizing force for whites. They are sharing information, and not just sharing information, they're sharing torture techniques on this is what you can better do to control niggers, black people. And I submit that still continues today. The very next sentence, it says innovation in violence, in fact, was the foundation of the widely shared pushing system. Enslaved migrants in the field quickly learned what happened if they lagged or resisted. The foundation of white supremacy, I think Mr. Fuller says that often, is direct violence. And just to hear that is innovation. That's what white people are sitting around thinking, refining. What can we do to them to punish them more? What can we do to terrorize them more? What kind of new techniques of violence can we concoct to try out on these black people? That was a stunning section of the reading for me. I thought that passage, right, same page, right at the bottom, where it talks about this beatings that took place and none of the slaves could do anything. I was curious if we were going to get any indictments of any of these folks as Sambos or Uncle Toms or sellouts, because they have a black enslaved black person who gets shot and killed in Mississippi and says none of the other slaves Sidney remembered said a word or turned their heads. They kept on hoeing as if nothing had happened. This is the system of white supremacy. Everybody has been, whatever term you want to use, compromised, cooperating, however you want to phrase it. And I just don't see the constructive value in, you know, going on a binge of indicting other victims for how they respond, which already got pointed out. Let's see. I think Roz already mentioned making sure that this torture is done publicly. I submit that that still happens today. You got all these snuff flicks that we've talked about before with these police killings. Let's see. The meals, you go out to do a whole day, and I mean, that doesn't even capture it. So you go out and you work sun up to sundown, 6, could be 7 days a week, and your rations, cornbread, a little salt, and one radish. Continuing, the elimination of most distinctions amongst the enslaved and the curtailment of possibilities for independence put into practice the theory incipient in the way entrepreneurs sold people at Maspero's. Everyone had a uniform status, that of cotton hand. The way I read this was everyone had a status of nigger. I don't care, male, female, child, elderly, whatever. Nigger, get out there. How can we make some money from you? And what are we going to do to torture you to make sure we maintain domination and control over you? Yeah, I thought that was just incredible where he's talking about Charles Ball and having to watch this female being beaten. Folks already gave great commentary on that. Again, just white people cannot be ignorant. I mean, this is so detailed. They have ledgers with the person's name on it and how much cotton you picked. You can't be ignorant and do all this, even coming up with new instruments, whether it's refining your whip or other weapons of violence. You can't be ignorant. You have to invest some mental energy into coming up with this stuff and sharing these techniques. And I just read the passage where he talked about that was the foundation of white people having a vested interest in making sure that other whites were maintaining control of their black people and sharing techniques, racist codification for how they're going to maintain their system. I just cannot emphasize that enough, that everything about this book, that seems to be, at least for me, an important point, that white people are not ignorant. It seems like there's a lot of deliberate effort in going about learning and sharing that information with other racists. The rate of infant mortality rates, I thought that was hugely important in the comparisons, the chart. It's in the book for those of you that have the book where he gives more detail around that. But that, we even talked about that on the compensatory call-in, that continuing to this very day. Pathological bullies that white supremacy bred in such high numbers preferred easier targets than someone as large and strong as Ball. But he could see that on the Congaree, if white folks thought that doing so would result in more cotton, they would find a way to bend even the toughest black man to the new bullwhip. Pathological bullies that white supremacy breeds, I would argue, to this day, you still see them out and about. Daniel Holtzclaw, whomever, insert name. That this continues, and those white teachers should not be forgotten, white women's role in being pathological bullies against us. Let's see, the passage I just talked about, mental health, yesterday, where it says, one Sunday exploring, Ball found a body dangling in the woods, a runaway despairing of escape, unwilling to return. And I thought that was really important, too, because it talked about, amidst all of these torture and violence and terrorism, breaking the will of black people, publicly humiliating, terrorizing other black people and having you helpless, isolating you. We're going to move you 500 miles away from everybody and selling you by yourself, making sure we don't sell you with, if you're married, if you have children, it's just going to be you. We're going to send all the people that you care about. They'll be, you know, on a plantation that's another 1,000 miles away, to instill a sense of hopelessness and despair, to make you more docile and easier to control. I thought that was hugely important in just showing the psychology of white terrorism, that this is not just bumbling idiocy, that this is all strategically, methodically planned with every move that they make about making sure that they maintain and increase, strengthen their control over us. Let's see, moving forward, there's some really interesting pictures. If you have the book, if you don't, you know, it's no big deal. But if you do have the book, really interesting pictures. I'll try and read some of the captions as we roll along. The cotton, the pounds of cotton that they forced, the forced labor produced, astronomical. I think some of these numbers came up when we read 12 Years a Slave. And I think in that book, it was mentioned that some of the top pickers, crack pickers, I think is the name that was used here, that they picked 500 pounds. And I think we even had a discussion. I don't know if folks remember, but we had a discussion about like, wow, is that a lie? Like, that's not even believable. But to see that those type of numbers come up again, and even where it says that on some of these Mississippi terror plantations that, you know, some of the black enslaved people averaged 341 pounds each on a gun. I mean, that is, I can't even fathom. My mind can't even do the math on that. And just to position that with the fear, the terror that was forcing them, compelling them to pick these astronomical quantities with being beaten and everything that we've heard. It just, again, this is not white privilege that's being described. I thought it was really important, too, because I have heard that argument frequently about, quote unquote, free labor is more efficient than enslaved labor, and the importance of really driving at home that that is totally false, that these pathological racist terrorists, that they extracted astronomical efficiency and productivity from enslaved black laborers and the ingenuity. I think that's important too. I mean, primary, the terrorism that's forcing this, but the ingenuity that these victims of racism came up with to produce all of this that, you know, black people just stole from them. Let's see. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? Yeah, we'll stop there. But the person that dialed in is 6353. Did you have a quick comment that you wanted to get in as we're closing out here? 6353.
Yes, this is Sunny from L.A.
Greetings.
I saw quite a few things that you saw, Gus, and those were excellent comments. And I was on page 117 as well. I was going to comment on those, but you did such a thorough job. I will say that spoofing system, just evil. So what they would do, it sounds to me like they find the biggest, toughest, fastest black person on the planet in the field, and then it's like in tandem, you line him up or her up together, and then you accelerate everybody else, and everyone else is required to toe the line. And strong, sick, well, ill, not feeling well, or headache, none of that. The enslavers on page 117, carry the furrow and set the pace. Okay, those are the words from the book. I'll be trying to be a little faster here. And the enslavers shared innovations, which you talked about, Gus, but I just want to reiterate. The world cotton market was an example of what economists call perfect competition. In fact, it was the example. It was later used in the 19th century as the archetype in which the great economist, British economist Alfred Marshall, discovered the famous concepts of supply and demand curves. So this is a world, a form of terrorism where they've built a whole economy not only on our ancestors and our labor, but also in their educational systems where they studied it to the point where they were able to erect economic systems just from what they learned. And the innovation of violence, which you mentioned also, Gus, was whip him into pace on the same page, take him down if there's any resistance whatsoever, and let everyone see it. Going to page on page 124 quickly, the white women as and all of the items they're buying from the forced labor and terrorism that they've inflicted on black people. As the wife of a Louisiana planter complained in 1829 about nothing but how the profits of the cotton now in the fields would let them continue buying plantation and Negroes. So let's not leave out the white women and their participation. Cotton is how they, even the ladies talk learnedly upon the subject. So we're talking about the white women as well. Last thing, in their heads, in conversations, this is on page 125, in their heads, in conversations, and on paper, planters obsessively calculated equations of hands and cotton, always coming up with the same solution, wealth. And the mathematics and calculations would stump even the world-class mathematicians. A visitor reported that according to Florida calculations on page 125, a hand generally makes from 5 to 6 bales weighing 400 pounds at 15 cents per pound. 5 bales to the hand will give $300, and at 15, 6 bales will give you $360, as at 10, 5 bales will give you 200, and 6 bales at 10 cents will give 240. I mean, in their head, they're calculating our labor for their profit, and so this is how they got to that figure on page 127, along with the things I've mentioned, the graph on page 127, how they went from 25 pounds to over to 300, so forth. Just terrorism. Okay, thank you. And Voltron effect, of course.
Ashe, ashe. We did our 3 hours. I have to say again, I think this narrator is going pretty quickly. Just in comparison to the other books that we've read, to me, it sounds like he's reading pretty rapidly as we move through this. Other folks can share next week, you know, their comments on that if you have any. But we are about a third, roughly a third of the way through the text. Again, hope it is a little less than a third. Hope folks are getting some constructive information and keeping in mind that this is written by a racist suspect. But we'll pick up on chapter 4 is where we are next week, next Friday. We'll be back tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll review news and observations from the past 7 days and winding down the quote-unquote holidays, all that. Looking forward to hearing from folks tomorrow, as well as workplace racism. We'll chat roughly 24 hours. If folks are listening to the archives and you have any comments that you want to share, feel free. You can drop an email and we'll just read them on the air. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Again, UntilJustice@gmail.com. With that, we will wrap things up. Great commentary, great observations from all the folks who participated, and we'll look forward to doing it again next Friday. I will say again, particularly given what we heard this week, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Know this week it's going to be a lot of enforcement officers out and about. Pathological white bullies are going to be out this weekend. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with them. Buckle up if you are going to be out and about. Dr. Kanban would encourage after 10, 11 o'clock this weekend, maybe you should stay in the house. That would be the best precaution unless you absolutely got to be out. And I would submit, certainly, if you're going to be driver, passenger, even a pedestrian, you do not want to be under the influence. They are looking to make problems for us. They already got those calculations in their head. Oh, I can bang him up, charge him with this, help me get a promotion. They have the same thought pattern that we heard in this book this week. We want to be lucid and clear thinking so we can make the best possible decisions. Keep your defenses up. You heard that in the text this week. When we go out in a world dominated by white terrorism. Once again, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with
ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. And once again, our thoughts, prayers, energy goes to Dr. Frances Cress Welsing and her family. We wish her a speedy recovery, and her sister as well, who's also been having medical difficulties. We just know that so many of our listeners and so many readers and Black people who have been constructively impacted by her life work are thinking about her, praying for her, and really hoping that she's able to recuperate and continue her much needed work. Thoughts and prayers to Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. Context of White Supremacy, signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.